and $250 billion in damages, according to Tom Jordan, director of the Southern California Earthquake Center. Between 142,000 and 735,000 people could be displaced if such a trembler hits. They did not know this before. In Canada, they have decided to shorten the hours of their suicide hotline. Listen to this one. A Canadian province will shut its 24-hour suicide hotline and replace it with one that operates only during business hours. Prince Edward Island, which is a small province on Canada's east coast, says it is way too expensive to operate the hotline around the clock. So starting on June 1st, it will open only between 9 a.m. and 5 p.m. Monday through Friday. The plan drew protest from mental health groups across the country there. Here's a quote. How many times when you get upset or worried or concerned about things, it's in the middle of the day. It's usually 3 or 4 o'clock in the morning when you wake up, according to Joan Wright. She's the executive director of the Canadian Association for Suicide Prevention. The hotline received 1,400 calls a year, and about 50 were from people contemplating suicide. So the situation there in that province, the hotline open only from 9 until 5. The CIA is conducting a cyber war game this week geared to simulate a major internet attack by enemy computer hackers. Dubbed Silent Horizon, the three-day unclassified exercise is based on a scenario set 5 years in the future and involves participants from government and the private sector. These are people who could likely be affected or enlisted in a very real situation, according to some intelligence sources. It's the goal to help the United States recognize indicators of a large-scale cyber attack. Now, the exercise was being conducted in Charlottesville, Virginia, by members of the CIA's Information Operations Center, which evaluates foreign threats to U.S. computer systems, particularly those that support critical infrastructures. The federal government has conducted various attack simulations since 9/11. The attacks on New York and Washington, which killed 3,000 people, prompted the U.S. war on terrorism. Top U.S. intelligence officials say it may only be a matter of time now before the United States is attacked again by terrorist groups, including Osama bin Laden's al-Qaeda. Cyber attacks, which have drawn less publicity than possible chemical, biological, or radiological and nuclear attacks, are viewed by U.S. officials as a potential al-Qaeda weapon against the U.S. economy. Well, we've been following this story on Coast to Coast, and it continues to get stranger, but Iraq's most lethal insurgent group appears now to be facing some kind of leadership crisis amid conflicting reports about the fate of its leader, Abu Musab al-Zarqawi, and whether a Saudi militant now has been named to stand in for him. Nobody really knows what's going on, how injured Zarqawi just might be. But in a moment, we'll check with Douglas Hagman from Homeland Security U.S., see if he can update us on this very strange situation in a moment on Coast to Coast AM. Well, Douglas Hagman is the director of the Northeast Intelligence Network. He's also the CEO of Hagman Investigative Services. We turn to him whenever there's any breaking news in the terrorism front, and we will do that again right now. Douglas, thanks for coming back on Coast to Coast at such a short notice. Appreciate it. How are you, by the way?
Great, sir, and thank you very much for having me on. It's great to be back on.
Me too. Now, we'll talk a little bit about Osama bin Laden in a moment, but first this strange story about this Iraqi, this Jordanian who has been in Iraq, on just what's going on. Does there appear to be now some kind of a power struggle? He's wounded, apparently. What's going on, Doug? What have you heard?
Boy, I'll tell you, great question. Obviously, there's a lot of confusion surrounding this, most wanted terrorist in Iraq. Essentially what we're hearing, last week there was a legal brief issued by Zarqawi that was posted on the internet. It was actually a rambling type of a treatise, that was allegedly attributed to, Abu Musab al-Zarqawi. And in that posting, he quoted, many Quranic references citing it's okay to, for the jihad warriors to make attacks and to kill Muslim women, children, so on and so forth. It was kind of an unusual posting. Following that, this past week, we had a posting by Abu Masir al-Iraqi, who is the alleged successor of Zarqawi, saying that Zarqawi was injured at the beginning of May, perhaps, cites the Battle of Uhud, which talks about Muhammad being injured and likens him to Muhammad. So that started the rampant speculation that Zarqawi was indeed injured or taken out of the terrorist operations. Now, this coincidentally, and I was talking to Steve Quayle today about this, this coincidentally comes at the same time when the Syrian-U.S. relations have grown cold, and we're looking at the possibility, which this has not really been brought up recently, that, you know, perhaps Zarqawi might have been injured, and he, it could very well have been, he could have been moved to, into Syria, if he's not still in Iraq. That's a very good possibility, and that would explain, or would, could possibly explain some of the, cold shoulders with Syria. But the bottom line is this, there are so many rampant, theories out there, so many speculation, about his fate right now. It's a very good possibility, and I know Joe Farrow ran with this at the beginning of May, that there was an offensive that started about May 7th, I believe it was, that was really focused on Zarqawi's group. And about that time, or a little bit earlier, is when, or back in February too, there was an indication that Zarqawi may have been wounded even before that, when the military had chased him near a checkpoint, and they allegedly found his laptop with some photographs and some documentation on there that he could have been being treated for ill health at that time. So whether we've got a number of different theories out there, one could be that this is a massive disinformation campaign, internal power struggle, or in fact it could be that Zarqawi indeed has been injured, taken out of the picture, incapacitated, or he could very well be dead. You know, it's now our people, our contacts at the Pentagon are, I spoke to a contact today who is of the opinion, and this is his own opinion, that in fact that Zarqawi has been injured to some extent, and combined with that, there is a consequential power struggle going on right now.
Apparently, what I hear, Douglas, shot in the lung, and also two doctors may have accompanied him into some country. Maybe it is Syria. This tells me one thing, though, Douglas, that no matter who these people are, the bin Ladens, the Sikoris, whoever they may be, if something happens to them, it just sounds like other people just keep coming. So will it ever end?
Well, you know, there's 50 attacks a day on average in Iraq right now, and 80% are not attributed to Zarqawi. So 20% are. Looking at those statistics, I would say no, because I think there are. This operation, as Army Brigadier General Carter Hamm had said, his organization is much bigger than just one person. So I think that the ideology there that's guiding these series of attacks is a lot greater than any one person. So I don't think, no, to answer your question, no, I don't think that this is going to end anytime soon, regardless of the status of Zarqawi.
At the time that we went into Iraq, Doug, Iraq really was not a harbor of the terrorists that we were chasing all over the world. So I'm a little bit concerned now that we have helped create a bigger tinderbox by doing what we're now doing. Is it your thought, too, and the people you've talked to? I mean, are we creating a bigger problem by being there now, or have we really done the job to fight the terrorism? Because as far as I'm concerned, bin Laden, wherever he may be, these people are still out somewhere planning some kind of attack on us here. I don't think that's gone away yet.
Oh, not by a long shot. I think that it is more dangerous today, just for the very reasons you mentioned, because in the court of world opinion, and especially in the court of Muslim world opinion, by us invading Iraq, we have done a lot more damage to our credibility in the Middle East or in the Muslim world than, in fact, had we not invaded Iraq, and especially for the reasons that we alleged. So I think that we are a lot, the ground that we are standing on is a lot more tenuous today than it was prior to our invasion of Iraq or our attack.
So maybe we're not winning the war on terrorism, Doug.
Well, I think in the short run here, I think we're suffering some severe setbacks, especially, like I said, in the court of world opinion. In the long run, I'm just wondering if in fact this occupation now that we have of Iraq is not part of a larger military strategy to gain a foothold over there, knowing what's coming down the road with Iran, perhaps, and Syria, and just having a base of operations in the Middle East where we could launch military offensives from, perhaps. It's kind of hard to say. I'm no military expert, but it would seem to me, boy, if we could have a bunch of our military assets in Iraq under the auspices of toppling a dictator and, you know, freeing the Iraqi people and rooting out terrorism, have a stage for later operations, that would be a thing to do.
Well, there's no question, Douglas. This is a war economy now. We're in it today. We're going to be in it tomorrow, and I'm afraid we're going to be in it for years to come. Don't you?
Absolutely, sir. I see no end to this at all. I think that the ideologies that are behind this war, and as you mentioned, the economy, I think are all key factors that play into this, and I think that we're going to be at this for a long time.
Well, the situation then back in Iraq, if Zaqawi is indeed gone, if he has fled to a neighboring country, and there's a high likelihood that he probably has, he is probably not going to be that effective. Where has he gotten his money to do what he was doing, to buy and arm these people and to do what they were supposed to do? I mean, where's that coming from?
That's a great question. You know, you look at him, he's a 37-year-old Jordanian who was nothing more than a petty criminal in Jordan, went over to Afghanistan with bin Laden. I mean, this guy is barely literate. He's more like a gangster in the Islamic circles. And now he's the, at one time, by the way, he was rivaling bin Laden because of the disparity between the two. Now you've got him being the head of this this Al-Qaeda-like organization, or offshoot of it. Where's the money coming from? I will say this. I believe, based on our research, a lot of the money is coming from the United States. And I'm not saying the United States government, but I'm saying funding through...
people, supporters, sympathizers.
Absolutely. And that could be very well be a reason, too. We discussed this, why that we have not sustained any type of crippling attack yet, is because a lot of money is being channeled out of this country overseas.
Well, that may be. Most upsetting that they can't find bin Laden. Where is he?
Boy, I'll tell you, if I knew that, I'd be we'd all be a little bit richer, I think based on the totality of documentation that I've read over the last, especially over the last several weeks, I would have to say that I'd be looking very, very hard at the tribal areas of Pakistan at this point, even Iran, perhaps. Now, you know, boy, we got to be careful when we say Iran, because then people say, well, you're just saying that because, you know, you want to invade another country, or, you know, you're complicit in facilitating the opinion that we need to invade Iran, perhaps. My best guess, just based on all the documentation I've seen, would be a well-guarded tribal area of Pakistan somewhere.
Yesterday I had a report that the FBI had advanced knowledge of the situation in the Oklahoma City bombing, and that this will come out in some court proceedings. I've got a roundtable discussion in June on 9/11, Douglas, where members of that panel will try to convince everyone listening that some members of government were fully aware of the attacks on the World Trade Center before they occurred. If all these come to be, if they are indeed true, that they knew in advance of the Oklahoma City bombing, and it is very strange that a lot of law enforcement, they were not in that building at the time, and that possibly people in government were aware of 9/11 and decided not to do anything about it for whatever reason. What does that do to the faith of the American people as they look at government?
By the sheer fact that this is coming out now, and you know, our relationship with Jana Davis about the Oklahoma City bombing and all of the information I know that was refused by the FBI. I mean, hard copy documentation that was refused by the FBI back in 1995, 1996, 97, that may have been a silver bullet that could have stopped perhaps 9/11. I'm becoming more and more convinced that there's the information that was known at the time by our intelligence agencies could very well have stopped or at least mitigated the damages the attacks between, we'll say, 1995 and 2001. To answer your question, however, I think that there's a growing trend right now with the American public to be really skeptical about any intelligence that comes out of the Beltway, and I think that that is only going to grow and fester, and I think that we are going to lose in the long run, the American people are going to lose faith in the long run of our intelligence services and their ability to predict the next attack and even question their willingness to stop the next attack. You know, when you have a key congressman, key senators like Rohrabacher and Henry Hyde saying, look, we just don't want to reopen old wounds here in spite of two dozen witness statements and in spite of additional documentation. To me, that says a lot about our political system at this point.
Well, and you know, Douglas, you really sit back to contemplate the words of the late President Dwight David Eisenhower when he, as he was leaving office, warned us all about the military-industrial complex, and this was coming from a decorated World War II hero, a general. To be aware of the military-industrial complex, and you know what? If you look at what's going on right now, it smacks of that, doesn't it?
Precisely. And I think, as a matter of fact, no truer words, I think, at this point have been spoken about the times we live in right now. And I think that we would be well advised to go back and study the words and study the context in which that statement was made. And I think that we're going to see that we are living out what Eisenhower had indicated.
Well, as we approach the Memorial Day weekend, and of course, pay our deepest respects to our fallen soldiers in all wars, Douglas, it's a time to reflect, and I just wish that there was a way out for us in this situation. And like you say, I don't see it. I really don't.
No, and we were talking about this before. I know Steve and I were Steve Quayle and I were talking about this, and our analysts. You know, it's amazing some of the information that we pass along to the higher level people in D.C. about what we find in the information we pass along to what we call the grunts and what they call themselves as the grunts on the street. You know, we have a very patriotic grassroots infrastructure, I guess, the people that are out there fighting the war on terror every day, a whole lot different than the suits behind the desk in Washington. And I think that any change is going to come from the bottom, from the people on the street, people that really care about this country, care about where we're going, as opposed to from the top down.
Well, you make sure you're listening to our roundtable discussion in June, Douglas. Even you, the man who's got his finger on the pulse, I think you're going to get some fascinating facts from that panel, okay? Douglas Hagman, HomelandSecurityUS.com, that's his website. When we come back, authorities, by the way, are striking back at Star Wars pirates. They're going all over the place, chasing these people down who have gotten advanced copies on the Internet of the new Star Wars movie way before the movie even hit the theaters. I'll be back with that and the rest of our open lines in just a moment. The phone numbers west of the Rockies, 800-618-8255. East of the Rockies, 800-825-5033. First-time caller, 818-501-4721. And the wild card line, 818-501-4109.
The official website of Coast to Coast AM is www.coasttocoastam.com. Log on now.
when a star is born, they receive a gift or two. One of them is this: they have the power to make a dream come true. When you wish upon a star, makes no difference who you are. Anything your heart desires will come to you.
Live from somewhere deep below the earth, this is Coast to Coast AM with George Norrie. To reach George from west of the Rockies, dial 800-618-8255. From east of the Rockies, dial 800-825-5033. First-time callers may reach George by dialing area code 818-501-4721. International callers may reach George by dialing your in-country Sprint access number and pressing option 5. Then dialing toll-free 800-893-0903. This is Coast to Coast AM with George Norrie on Premier Radio Networks.
And we're going to have open lines for you for the rest of this hour. And by the way, a couple days ago, federal authorities shut down a website used to find movies, which were used to distribute the new Star Wars movie, even before it was shown in the theaters. And they conducted search warrants in 10 cities across this country, including, there's just a few of them, Austin, Texas, Erie, Pennsylvania, Clintonwood, Virginia, Germantown, Wisconsin, and Chicago, a city in Ohio, Anaheim, Leavenworth, Kansas, all over the place. They mean business for people who are pirating these movies. Did you have a chance to preview it on the internet? Do you want to say? Well, we'll have our open lines. We'll talk about that and a number of other issues when we come back. The After Dark newsletter, by the way, the June issue is the very special UFO edition, and there's some great stories there, including as a military secretly working on back engineering ET craft. I guess that could possibly be true, too. A couple ways to order. There's a toll-free number, 24-7, 1-888-727-5505, or you can go online at coasttocoastam.com. And just a reminder, on Monday, of course, Memorial Day, that night we will have a live Coast to Coast program. No best of that night. Let's go to the phones. Wildcard Line, welcome to the program. You are on the air, and where are you calling from? Hi.
Hi, George. This is John calling from Galveston County, Texas.
Hey, John.
I have a really bizarre story to tell you that came over the news on Thursday that a fellow, I guess late last night or early Thursday morning, was shot 6 or 7 times, and his body was dumped outside the Baylor College of Medicine. Now, in the man's possession, they found bus tickets. They didn't say where to, along with some Mexican currency. And now on the 10 o'clock news on one of the local news stations, somebody came out with a story that this man was working on a genome project.
Oh, no. Here we go again.
Here we go again. Now, the man has yet to be identified, and I'm sure they have to contact his next of kin before they can do that. But check the news coming out of Houston over the next couple of days to see if this thing grows anymore, because there's something really suspicious about it that the man, they said, well, they didn't find any shell casings. Well, if somebody used a revolver on him, you're not going to find shell casings. But the man was shot at least 6 or 7 times and dumped in front of a very busy medical center there, in front of the Baylor College of Medicine, in front of one of their office buildings, apparently, not the hospital itself. And
I tell you, John, this is all too common, these strange murders of these scientists.
And we're supposed to believe that, things happen. Well, I don't believe in accidents. I don't believe in coincidence, especially when it happens this often to so many prestigious scientists and doctors and microbiologists all over the world. I mean, it's one of those things that's like winning the lottery back to back.
And finally, yeah, at the same store.
Yeah, at the same store with the same ticket.
You know, finally, a number of these biologists and scientists are beginning to wake up about this. A year ago, when Stephen Quayle and I were talking about this, nobody really popped up to say, what are they saying? Now this is going to become, mark my words, a national story, perhaps international story, because some of these biologists and microbiologists and scientists are from other countries as well. This is a major story. The big question is why? What the heck is happening to them? Why are people systematically dying, getting bumped off, under strange circumstances, some of their deaths? Why is this happening? First-time caller line, you're on the air with us. Hi there.
Hello, how are you?
I'm doing fine, thank you.
That's good. I was just calling in because I'd listen to, when I can. I don't always have an opportunity, but I was listening, and earlier you were talking about if the government knew in advance about 9/11, how the people would react to that.
Mm-hmm.
And people always say, you know, that they would lose faith in the government. And it's not the entire government's fault.
Not at all. You're absolutely right.
In the government. I mean, I'm a U.S. soldier, and I have faith in my government. That's why I'm a U.S. soldier. But I think we should do an investigation, and the individuals that knew should be, you know, fired or something. But you can't blame the whole government like everybody tends to do.
I am so glad that you've called with that. And also, so many people, when people start knocking issues like this, so many people misunderstand what they're saying. They think that we're opposed to the country, or people are opposed to the country when they hear anything like that. That's the farthest from the truth. What you just said is the most poignant thing I've heard from anybody, and that is, some individuals are the people who are partly responsible for some of these things. Those are the ones that you need to go after. Not all of them. We've got some people who are dedicated Americans who are doing whatever they can to make this a great country. And that's so important for people to understand. I'm glad you pointed that out.
Well, that was, you know, you always hear that all over the news, and it's not the government. And that just bugs me that they would say that, when the government has done so many things for us in the past and in the present.
We're talking about some people who are opportunists, who have their own agenda. They have their own globalist plan. Those are the people we need to get to.
And we need to find something to find them and weed them out of the program, because it'll be a better government.
Oh, there's no question about it. Here's the problem. They are so intertwined. They are so powerful. They are everywhere. It's going to be very difficult to get to them. And that's another reality we have to face.
But it's something that needs to be done.
Absolutely. Hey, thanks for your call.
Anytime. Thank you.
Appreciate that. That guy's got his act together. East of the Rockies, welcome to Coast. You're on the air. Hi there.
Hi, good morning, George.
Good morning. Where are you calling from?
I'm calling from York, Ontario, Canada.
Well, hello
there. I'm
enjoying
the call so far, and I think the first two are actually related. I'd like to see with Stephen Quayle some policing authority, maybe from Interpol, to actually assess things as you start to further interview Stephen Quayle on some of this. I'm calling about this earlier report about something going on in the east coast of Canada, some closing of a suicide prevention line because of costing. And I was
actually closing, but reducing the hours from 9 to 5.
Reducing the cost for the calls. And I was
speaking
with Richard Stallman, the developer of the GNU/Linux operating system, which is this fascinating movement going on in America that's challenging all proprietary software. And it's an operating system that is open source. You can share all the source code. And I wanted to know from him, who's the lead in North America on voice over internet protocol, the free internet phoning, because it challenges even the proprietary that's said to be 90% less than long distance calls and based on the open source. And he cited David Sugar. And I'm looking at the internet and all these fascinating organizations, the International Soft Switch Consortium. And so I thought it'd be a good idea for you to bring on David Sugar, maybe have David Sugar and Richard Stallman, this award-winning software developer, to come on air and to describe this movement and what open source means and what voice over internet protocol can do.
All right, tell me this though for a layman, because I'm not a computer genius by any means. What does all this mean to me?
Well, the voice over internet protocol is a voice protocol for the internet, and it comes under the Internet Engineering Task Force, or the IETF.org, which is the various protocol for all of the Internet under ICANN, this premier body.
You've still lost me. What does this mean?
Well, Voice over Internet Protocol means that you can communicate freely on the Internet using your phone. You're now no longer tied to the telecommunication giant. So let me point out, if the larger telecommunications interests had a claim to the monies they were losing as a result of this changeover, they would have been through the courts and through civil action challenging that. Well, it tells me that there's a kind of WorldCom coming down the pipe that would reveal that these guys were bilking us out of money all along for long-distance calls they had no justification for making.
How much is involved, do you think, in terms of money in this? Billions of dollars?
Many billions of dollars worldwide.
Okay, I'll look into that. That may be a story down the line. Let's go to our wild card line. Welcome to the program. You're on the air. Hi there.
Hey, this is Jonathan calling from Somerville, South Carolina.
Hey, Jonathan, how are you?
Great. I saw Star Wars on the Internet. It was kind of grainy and the sound was bad, and I wouldn't really recommend it. I haven't seen it in the movie theater yet, but it wasn't really anything. You know, it's worth paying though, what, $7-$8. But I really feel like that the movie industry is going about this all the wrong way, because every time they shut down a new protocol, they just pop up a new better one. They start out where it took like 4 hours to, or 40 hours to download a movie, and now all of a sudden they've got BitTorrent and you can download a movie, and like I did it in 2 hours.
Almost, it's real time, basically.
Yeah.
Right?
I mean, it was quick. But, I mean, like I say, I don't really recommend it. I mean,
no, not at all. And, you know, and it's not worth it. It's unfortunate that that stuff happens. I assume somebody at one of the production houses got the pirated copy, or do you think somebody from a theater somehow got it and was able to get it, put it on his disc, or did whatever he had to do and then fed it all over the world? How do you think they do this?
Well, actually, it looked like it came from a, like the cutting room floor, because there was like numbers at the top. And they counted up from 0 to 24, like the number of frames. And they actually, in some of the scenes, they had like two versions of the scene. In one of the scenes, they had a robot's head blow up, and then they replayed the scene right afterwards, and they had like a different version of the robot dying. So
let me ask you a detective question then. Right. Of every 10 people who would see that on the Internet, how many of them do you think would go see the movie in a theater once they saw it on the Internet?
It's hard to say. I mean, I think most of the people who download movies honestly wouldn't go.
They would not go. Okay.
No.
So I was thinking, you don't think it's some kind of a sinister plan to get people excited about the movie and then they'd go to the theater?
Actually, I heard that Battlestar Galactica. It wasn't very popular, and they got it distributed on the Internet, and all of a sudden there was a lot of hype about it. So you may be right with that.
You never know about publicity. I'll tell you, of course, in this particular case, this Star Wars movie, which I'm told is the best. I'm going to see this in a couple weeks. I always like to wait a little bit, let those crowds die down. But I think in this case it was a pirate. But I also think in some other cases that they just leak things out and they want a little publicity, and you know, everybody goes crazy over it. Let's pick it up by going to our wild card line. Your turn. You're on Coast to Coast. Hi there.
Well, hello, and yes, it's I'm Dr. Richard, and 1560 KNZR in Bakersfield, California.
I like that. You should have been the announcer for that station.
I was a finalist in their recent Talk Radio Idol contest.
Were you?
And, George, if I had the pleasing presentation that you possess, I definitely would have been the grand champion.
I don't know about that, but you know what? I'm glad you got close.
More than close. In fact, I can invite you to be a celebrity judge. We had the sheriff of Kern County. We had the DA. Congress people were in on it. Yes.
I just may do that.
One big politician thought I sounded like Kirk trying to play Hamlet.
I love it.
Big topics to quickly touch on with you, George.
Okay.
And my question is concerning embryonic stem cell research. And we all know you can cure and maybe prevent disease and treat illness. But are there national security issues involved in the stem cell research? And I'm thinking about Korea or China possibly doing the key work ahead of us.
Yes, there's no doubt about that. If we don't do it, some other nation will. And I still think we should be able to do it from the umbilical cords like so many scientists believe we can. We don't even have to worry about the embryos.
And my other huge question is, what's going on at the Afghani-Pakistan border? Because I heard that the really bad guys, the ones who really want to kill us, the terrorists, they have a two-year world supply of opium paste in the tunnels there. So no matter how much money we spend on this war on drugs, they have the supply. So even if we close the border, even if we raise the price 100 times through the supply and demand, the really bad guys are going to make the money faster and easier because they have a two-year supply stored in the ground right there in Pakistan, Afghanistan.
I would not doubt that at all. At all. Keep in touch.
Thank you, George.
Appreciate you being on the program. Next up, Beast of the Rockies, where might you be? Hi there.
Good morning, George. I'm coming into Dallas.
All right. You driving a truck, I guess?
Yes, I am, and I'm listening to you on the XM radio.
Honk your horn if you can get away with it.
I got the old lady sleeping in the back, but there it goes.
Did she wake up?
I don't think so. I got a set of train horns on here, so it's really, really rugged far back there.
All right. What's on your mind? What's going on?
I'm going to tie a bunch of things together for you with one word.
Okay.
Illuminati.
You know what? You're right.
You look at the border crossings, you know, they're talking about scores of illegals coming across the border, just thousands, you know. And then you talk about, this is the greatest nation. I served Desert Storm. We have technology like you wouldn't believe. We tested, actually, when I was in the service. Our unit tested the GPS system, very first testing of the GPS system. 10 years later, boom, it's in everybody's cars. Everybody's got one in their pocket trying to figure out how to get to 32nd Street. The technology is immense. We got satellites up there watching these countries. You're telling me that people are moving about, and we have no idea where Osama is. We have no idea about this, about that. We have no idea. We're just going on intelligence. Come on now. The thing with the 9/11 taking away all of our rights or a lot of our rights, they would never be able to take away freedom of speech, different things that they've taken away with this, what's his name, Act?
Well, you see, I find it very difficult, too, that with all this kind of technology, with satellites that can read a license plate on a car, that we don't know where some of these people are. I think, like you do, I think we know where they are. I think we're monitoring them. But there's a bigger picture here. I think greed has greed or the Illuminati or a combination of two, has destroyed this planet, quite frankly, and that there were greedy people in the United States, in France, in Russia, in Great Britain. And these people, once you have so much money, what's the next game for them? It's
power,
the power.
Control.
Absolutely.
Exactly.
That's what they want. They want to move us around. Like
George, my hat's off to the serviceman that called a little bit. Thank you very much for doing a good job for us. But he's saying specific people in government. Now, he's absolutely right, but look at the immigration situation. There are people losing their jobs every day. We got industry going down there. We got them coming up here. Everybody's worried about this, the border closing. How do we know, not communists, but Al-Qaeda's not coming right across with the Mexicans?
This is a long-term plan
to
do away with all the borders.
Why isn't senators, why aren't they focusing on closing the border? Everybody I talk to on the road here is like, oh, yeah, sure, just let them across. We got a bunch of people down there for their own free are down there on the borders watching out and radioing ahead. I'm gonna punch out here, but I love the show. I've been listening to you since the early 90s. Know you're coming up on a commercial. Keep doing the good work, bud.
Okay, you got it. Well, you listened to Art then, and then you've been listening to me now. But you hit it on the head with that one word, the Illuminati. And that, my friends, that is what is steering a lot of this. You're going to find out about it more and more when we do some of these roundtable discussion programs, how these people who are so power-hungry are just merely trying to take advantage of everybody else on the planet. And it's not just in a government. It's not just here. It's not just in England. It is all over the place. You've got groups of people, and you'll see, and some of you already do, by the way, just by some of the emails I get on a regular basis, you know what the puzzle looks like. It's just a matter of putting the pieces together. Do we have time for one more quick one? Probably not. Can you do this in less than a minute? If not, we're out of time. What do you think? Hello?
Yes.
Yeah, I've got about a minute for you. Is that going to be enough time for you?
Yes, George.
Okay, go real fast.
George, this is Bob. My son works at a theater, and they preview the movies, the employees there. He operates a projector, and it would be very easy, and it is very easy for someone to come in with a small camera, and as they're previewing the movie, looking for flaws once it's shipped to the theater, to put that up on the internet once it's
done. Oh, I see. Grab it. So it's that grainy look, just like all our callers have been saying. And that's one of the ways they capture it. I thought so. I don't know if they'll ever catch him, though. Well, I'll be back in a moment with our very special guest tonight on Coast to Coast. This guy's a home run, Michael Tesarian. I'll be back at Coast to Coast AM.
Sign up now for Streamlink, now with podcasting. Get it today at coasttocoastam.com. Coast to Coast AM with George Norrie, live from somewhere deep below the earth on Premier Radio Networks.
Well, next week will be the last week in St. Louis for a while, and I head back to Los Angeles for a very lengthy stay back home in L.A., the City of Angels. By the way, also next week, a couple of the shows will have, by the way, I think, one of the best documented UFO alien abduction cases. Travis Walton will be our guest. Those of you who are into ufology, you know his name, Travis Walton. And also, next week, David Icke will be our special guest as well, so we've got a lot on tap for you. Imagine for a moment you're sitting around a table with a bunch of friends, and one of them just talks about fallen angels and says, you know what, I've got proof that fallen angels developed the lost continent of Atlantis. Well, first of all, after you stopped doing whatever you were doing, you'd look at your friend, your buddy, and say, you know what? Where in the heck did you get that theory? In a moment, we'll talk with our guest, Michael Tesarian, about that theory, Fallen Angels, Finding Atlantis, on Coast to Coast AM. Alternative historian and author Michael Tessarion is an expert on the occult history of Ireland and America. He's born in Ireland and has researched mythologies of the world as well as his own country's magnificent and mysterious Druid history. Michael's work considers the consequences to civilization of extraterrestrial involvement and answers many of the quandaries that have puzzled other visitation experts. It clarifies the disinformation about Atlantis and the lost continents of prehistory, and shows that the orchestrated chaos of today's world has roots in ancient times. Looking ahead, Michael offers some profound solutions for the future as well, and he will be our very special guest now on Coast to Coast AM. Michael, good to talk with you again, my friend. How are you?
George, I'm very well. Nice to be back with you. It's been a while. It's nice to be back on your show.
Yeah, it is. As a matter of fact, it's almost been a year, but I did see you at a conference, and by the way, you were spectacular as always.
Thank you. I was just going to mention the fact that I'm unhappy that I'm not going to be seeing you, I think it's tomorrow, isn't it, at the Conspiracy Con. That's because I did see you, you're right, when we honored Jordan. We did an honoring, I think you're talking about the banquet where we honored Jordan.
Up there in San Jose at the time.
Yeah,
that's right.
Yeah, that was so much fun. I mean, he definitely deserved it, and you know, I've kind of been carrying that little speech around in my pocket, you know, for a good, you know, 10 years. So it's like Brian Hall finally, you know, at Conspiracy Con gave me the opportunity to actually do it. I was begging him, me, look, you know, this thing is getting all torn and ratty looking. Can I just at least do it, you know?
I love it. Well, talk about Conspiracy Con. I don't know if you heard what happened to Jordan while he was on Coast to Coast with us about a month or so ago.
No, I didn't.
He was on the air. We were talking about a lot of the things that Jordan talks about.
Yeah.
All of a sudden, right at the end of the program, Michael, his phone goes dead. We can't get a hold of him. He starts getting threatening emails. It was a nightmare for him it was unbelievable for several days. He even called the phone company and said, please fix my phone. And they said, in so many words, we cannot fix it. We're not allowed to right now. I mean, it was incredible. Finally, I think things are getting back to normal for him.
I hope so. I'll have to give him a call. Well, I've been traveling and I've been out of the loop, but I knew I'd be seeing him at Conspiracy Con. This is unbelievable. Every time I meet him again, you know, he's got some other incredible tale to tell. He's a real Robin Hood in my eyes, where he's, you know, there's always some incredible, drama, you know.
It never ends. Yeah, it never ends. It cloaks him.
But this was just after you're saying that what you're saying is he was
right
on your show.
Right at the end of the program.
Right.
He was on for the show, and then right at the end, bloop, everything went.
How interesting.
Right in the middle of a question, as a matter of fact.
How interesting.
So do check in. We check in with him periodically. I haven't talked to him
in a couple weeks. But you're not going to be there yourself at Conspiracy Con this time, huh?
No, I'm not. I'm tucked away in St. Louis right now, and then I got to get back to L.A. in another week or so.
Well, we'll all be thinking about you, you know.
Okay. Michael, this latest work you've done, Atlantis, Alien Visitation, and Genetic Manipulation, just a tremendous job you've done. And,
thank you.
And I want to take some time to talk with you, first of all. So you can – I always like to get different views of a similar topic from people, and you bring a different perspective. So, you know, with the phrase fallen angels, to you, what is that?
Fallen angels are beings that we really need to know about outside of their religious context. We have religion in a way to thank, because religion, including the mythologies of the world, have preserved in their own very fanciful way, I might add. But in the fabric of the great mythologies and the fabric of religion, there has been this mention of people from out there, you know, coming down, fallen angels falling from heaven. And when you do a closer reading, and then you discover what this means outside of its religious context, what it really means is that we were, in the past, our Earth was in fact visited by very, very advanced beings. I mean, we're talking Mr. Spock, you know, plus many, many, many centuries perhaps. We were visited, and Carl Sagan and, you know, many of the top scientists of the world have been accepting this. There's no problem accepting that this planet has been visited and has continued, as many of your own guests will surely confirm, are continuing to be visited by alien beings. But the particular group that we now call the Nephilim, the Anunnaki, or the fallen angels, they chose to do something that most other visitors do not do. It is that prime directive that you hear about in science fiction. They broke that. They actually did interfere with the beings that they found here, who, of course, were our ancestors. instead of just coming here and doing research and, you know, and minding their own business and then leaving, like I would assume that most other visitors do, and that's perfectly allowable, they broke cardinal law. They broke moral law by interfering with the destiny of the human race. And that particular contingent, some people say there were only 200 of them, that particular contingent, I believe, and my intense research is into this, visited us between 30 and 50,000 years ago, set up their continent of Atlantis on a now missing continent called Appalachia. That's a piece of disinformation that needs to be cleared up. Atlantis itself was not a continent. It was on another continent that has subsequently sank under the waves. And these beings then did start to actually make interactions with our ancestors, attempted mating with the Earth females, and subsequently crossed their own DNA, their own alien DNA. This is the shocker for most people, but we can't have an understanding of our world history without understanding this, that our DNA, as is soon to come to light in the next 10 years, it was
Are these fallen angels what Zachariah Sitchin reported in his writings of the 12th planet when he talked about Sumerians and visitations by extraterrestrials, or are they a different group?
No, it's the same group, and this man has done remarkable work. Basically, he has come up with the same understandings. We basically agree, because I looked into the Celtic legends and found exactly what Zechariah had already discovered in the Babylonian Sumerian record. He calls them the Anunnaki or the Anunnaki, the ones, Anki or Anunnaki just means those who came from heaven to earth. So absolutely, these are the gods of antiquity, the people that were taken for the gods. I mean, they're not gods, but they were so sophisticated, you know, that they were taken for gods. Now, and bizarrely, in the Celtic record, the same facts are hidden. And the trouble with the Babylonian record is, you see, that was buried. That was literally physically buried beneath the earth in the old cylinder seals, you see, in the clay tablets.
Sure.
And it was the discovery of those clay tablets that started to take the lid off of it, so that people like Lawrence Gardner and like Zachariah Sitchin and like L.A. Waddell, they would grasp this point that our earth has been visited. There it is in pen and ink, you know, basically, in the Sumerian record. Well, in Irish mythology, it's been buried too, but not under the ground. It's been buried under all the fairy folk tales, all the magical, you know, stories and the fancifulness of it, and the old wives' tales, you know. So, of course, most people just throw that aside and don't understand what the Celts mean when they talk about these great weapons of power, or the kings that had magical abilities, or the changeling, you know, and the elven kings and the dragon under the mountain, and all of these amazing stories that we percolate down into the Arthurian tradition. But I, in Ireland, you know, started to look deeper. I did go into the field. I went to the actual megaliths. I started to hear what all the guides who take you on these guided tours were saying. I researched it. I read every book you can imagine on the subject, and just realized that what we're being told is not true, and that these cyclopean ruins, these astronomical earthworks, they're there for very special reasons, you know.
Okay.
And it's incredible. The Celtic legends are an equal, if not greater, resource on this subject than the Babylonian Sumerian record.
What I find to be staggering, Michael, is so many of these outside theories from other people, we've just heard about a few, all seemed then to move toward the same direction, including yours, on this group of fallen angels that came here, that visited 30 to 50,000 years ago to do what they needed to do. And I just find that to be just incredible, that, you know, we would get this and then we'd get the stories of them. So here's a question. How did we find out about them in these texts, in these stories? Why did these earthlings, I guess, write about them or pass the words on?
I'd love to discuss that with you, and I will, and I want to address the first point you made. The fact that we're all coming, or a lot of scholars are reaching the same conclusions, or at least, you know, hitting on the same thing, is get ready for it. It's going to increase. I am a firm believer that in the next 10 years, it's even going to get more. So we need to look for that a great deal of scholars, like Will Hart just wrote a fine book called The Genesis Race. You know, a lot of people are coming out with this kind of information. I had talks with Gerald Hancock, who wrote the book Talisman, and he is getting interested in the origins of evil and how that particular proclivity came into human beings. You see, so yes, all the people from their various researches, from their own houses, shall we say, from their own schools, as they are diligently and truthfully I'm not talking about charlatans here. I'm talking about really genuine people.
Good researchers. Solid researchers.
As they do their homework, inevitably, you know, I am no different than anyone else. I didn't set out to discover this or just, you know, come up with this on my own. It was diligent research, and everyone, I believe, will come upon the central hub of the truth. What your second, the question you asked me is related to, yes, how do the ancient books and the texts, what is all that? Where did it come from?
Right. Well, and why did they do it?
And why did they do it? It's because, you see, we know that from most of the great cultures of the world, granted, there was just an oral tradition. So the fact that we have anything in writing is already testament that it was mostly in what we would call the historical era, which started about 7,000 to 10,000 years ago. So very recently. If anything's in writing, it's pretty much modern in historical context. Because prior to 10,000 years ago, not too much was written down. Mostly it was an oral tradition. So the writings, I believe, as brilliant as some of them are, as lucid as some of them are, like the Book of Enoch, my God, you know, the Annals of the Four Masters, the Ramayana, the Mahabharata, the Norse Edda, the Mayan Popol Vuh, the Book of Taliesin, which is the Welsh chronicle. There are fascinating books out there, fascinating chronicles. Jack Barringer, who's another author who's also studied this, he says that he thinks that there's 30,000 texts in existence that talk about Atlantis and also the coming of the angels. And that's, he says, only those books that are left after all the burnings and the, you know, the desecration that took place in more recent times. So he's saying that there's already thousands. He's probably saying that there was whole libraries filled with information on this. But, of course, those written terms come out of an oral tradition because the coming of these visitors and their machinations and the great continents of old, the fact that these great continents in the prehistoric world were created, this is etched into the racial memory. It used to be, you know, it used to be literally the television of the ancient times.
Sure.
People, this was the stories. This is in the blood. Go to any Native American Indian culture. Go even to the Bushmen of Africa. I'm part Indian, by the way. You mentioned I'm from Ireland, but you see, I got a lot of this insight also, not only coming from the Celtic record, George, but also from the Aryan side, the Indian side of the Northern Himalayas, where my mother's from. This is to them completely known. This would not surprise them. They are amazed that anyone would listen to this and be surprised. They completely are aware that they had a serpent race and the Nagas and that the kings were descended, you know, from the skies and that we had Vamanas, which were flying crafts, and that the gods used nuclear weapons and thermal devices when they fought one another. This is standard stuff over in India.
The fallen angels, as they are, why did they decide to go astray? I mean, as you were mentioning, other extraterrestrial races played it by the universal law. They came, they witnessed. If they dabbled at all, Michael, it was for us to be better.
Yeah.
All of a sudden, this group decided to get involved. How come? What do you think?
That is one of the most remarkable stories. In fact, the first chapter of the book deals with that right away. In the book Atlantis that I did, that is the opening chapter because it's such an important question. The answer really is that the Nephilim, the fallen angels, did not come here by choice. This group was different in the fact that they were being pursued from their own solar system, which I believe was Alpha Draconis. But, you know, there's different theorists have different ideas. And the Nephilim were basically being ousted as a contingent from their own solar system. And actually, their pursuers were pursuing them across the galaxy. There's an incredible story behind this. And they strayed into our solar system, not by chance, not by will, but by necessity, because they were being pursued by their by people, contingents from their own planet. And
were they like criminals on their own planet, something like that?
Yeah, now we do think of that. Most writers say that they were the fallen ones, that they were scientists who had gone bad, who had violated the natural law, who were being expurged from their own societies. However, to be really factual about it, we don't know if the pursuers were any more moral or good than the ones they were pursuing. So, you know, technically we actually do not know that. And, you know, we have to use pantomime terms like, you know, good and evil just to make sense of this incredibly convoluted story. But there's no doubt about it that these individuals did not come to our planet by choice. And the story goes that when they came here, the planet was probably smaller than they knew. The ultraviolet light and the Schumann waves and all sorts of other phenomena were not what they were familiar with, so they didn't enjoy their time here, even though they never left.
Okay, so they get here, It wasn't their plan. They had to. They were fleeing.
Yeah.
All of a sudden, whose great idea was it to start breeding with human beings all of a sudden?
It was their leader. There's the source for that, by the way, and just in case people are interested in sources, my book is filled with sources, and also on the website there's a lot. But the source for that particular one is the Book of Enoch, which goes into this quite extensively. You see, first of all, they had to stay on our planet because their pursuers had, for reasons best known to themselves, destroyed a very large planet that used to be, and of course this will echo with people who are familiar with Zachariah Sitchin's work again, there was a planet called Tiamat, or the planet used to be called Lucifer. It was a very large planet, 15 times bigger than the Earth, that was between Mars and Jupiter. And that planet was an ocean planet, entirely ocean. Okay, and the pursuers, thinking that the Nephilim or the fallen ones were on that planet, destroyed it.
Oh my.
So there was a celestial havoc. And this celestial havoc, by the way, I know a lot of your listeners will immediately perk up, because this celestial havoc is well known through all the legends of the world. Emmanuel Velikovsky had a piece of this. You know, Zachariah Sitchin certainly talks about it, but many, many other scholars, many other references, many other books, and the Bible is also filled with this, about that havoc in the heavens. So the Nephilim had not actually been hiding on Tiamat, they had been hiding on the earth, and you and I do not drive our cars through earthquakes, you know, for fun.
That's absolutely true. So the asteroid belt that's up there between Mars and Jupiter was this planet.
It's the remnant of the planet. You know, some people have said that even Venus is a remnant of the planet. Some people say that the moon is. People say that the debris from Tiamat was pummeling our Earth, carved out the Pacific Basin.
Could have been.
Yeah, we're talking about a massive havoc. So it's not that these guys could just start up their engines, you know, even with the sophisticated spacecraft that they had. There was so much magnetic turmoil that they weren't going anywhere.
After this planet was blown up, Michael, did the pursuers merely take off and go back to their own planet?
Basically, that's what they did. They did one other very interesting thing, which I remember we got to a little bit on the last show. Before they left, they actually, now this is another piece of heavy information, but it is backed up by the Pista Sophia and the Bible and many, many other legends, especially Celtic legends and Native American Indian legends, back what I'm going to say up. And they say that the pursuers, before they left, just in case, the Nephilim, some of the Nephilim had been housed on our planet, they actually erected what is known as an ethereal or etheric barrier, like a membrane, an etheric membrane around our Earth to sheath it and to place it in quarantine. And this particular sheath is always known as the dragon, or the dragon's head and the dragon's tail. It's known by various names, you know, the great web in the sky. The Earth is now considered, you know, to be a silent planet.
Is it still around us?
Yeah, and that's the point. It is still there.
Well, let's talk about that and also how they created Atlantis when we come right back. I love this stuff. Our guest is Michael Tesserian. I'm George Norrie, and this is Coast to Coast AM.
Podcasting, the new way to get Coast to Coast AM to your computer. Available to all StreamLink subscribers at coasttocoastam.com. listening to Coast AM with George Norrie.
And with our very, very special guest tonight, Michael Tesserion. His website, taroscopes.com, TAROSCOPES.com. Linked up with his name on coasttocoastam.com. We'll be back with him, and we'll continue this fascinating discussion about the fallen angels that he says founded Atlantis. And we'll talk about that and so many other things in a moment on Coast to Coast AM. And welcome back to Coast, I'm George Norrie, Michael Tesserion, our guest. Michael, before we get into Atlantis and so many other things, talk about this sheath around the planet. Can scientists detect it?
Oh, I'm absolutely sure they can. The top scientists know all about it. In fact, they knew about it from the 1500s onwards. I think William Bramley has some information in his book, Gods of Eden, that, the Nephilim, or let's say the descendants of the Nephilim, because they've never been away and they're behind the thrones of religion and politics today, these individuals were discussing. Yeah, they had sent their craft up there in the 1500s after a long delay. And, of course, these things literally ricocheted right off of it. Richard Hoagland has some fascinating footage which shows them firing at it. Actually, I think that a lot of people misinterpreted the footage that he had. They thought that people were firing at the spacecraft. That is not the case. These were beams that were being sent up from the Earth and from the spacecraft and from the satellites onto the area of the grid, the barrier, in order to break through it, just like a burglar, would like to find a way to get through there. They've been busy at that one for at least 500 years. They've put the finest minds onto it. A lot of the actual scientific organizations, think tanks, and institutes that we are familiar with are actually nothing but fronts for the research about how to get through this barrier. Strange as it may be to most people listening, this is a well-known, beneath the surface in the secret societies. They're very busy, desperate. And in fact, I found out that one of the reasons why there's a lot of UFO sightings in Mexico is because the world elites that are working on this actually think, rightly or wrongly, that the barrier is weakest in the area that's close to Mexico. So people are always saying that there they see a lot of lights in the sky. In my book I have a whole chapter on HARP technology.
Yes.
That talks about that HARP is one of the weaponry that they're using. It's the microwave technology, the superheating the ionosphere, they've had nuclear detonations up there in the past.
They're trying to bust loose, I guess.
Yes,
huh?
They are. They're trying to bust loose. And there's also a lot of arcane occult imagery dating all the way back to the Middle Ages about the magician standing in his enclosing circle. We have mythologies of the dragon slayer slaying the dragon. Behind all those mythologies is what we're talking about. Slaying the dragon was a euphemism, of course, for many things, but it was a euphemism also for cutting through or breaking through the dragon, because the membrane that we're talking about, it was always likened by ancient astronomers and astrologers as a dragon's head and a dragon's tail. This is how the Chinese spoke of it. Their dragon dances are connected to this. Much of the symbolism of the serpent and the snake is actually connected to this all-embracing membrane that's up there. It allows beings to come in to our planet, but it will not let those with the alien DNA of the Nephilim get out. And that's why nobody has been, whether you believe people have been to the moon or not, let's just, for this conversation, grant that they have been to the moon. I actually don't believe that myself, but just let's say argument they have been. Okay.
I do, by the way. I believe we've been to the moon. But what you're saying, these are only beings with the DNA of the Nephilim.
Yeah. And that's
they can't get through. Okay.
No, and that's why we've been to the moon, but haven't been beyond it. At the very most, some kind of craft may go to Mars, but it's certainly not going to contain any humanoid person, that's for sure.
Interesting. That's a fascinating theory all by itself.
It is an incredible side issue. I didn't expect to come across this, but it absolutely makes a lot of sense of the kind of technology, the SDI, and now this new imperialism. We have the neocons today working heavily to arm space, and behind that, and behind HARP, and behind many of the other technologies, they may be put before us as saying we need this because of domestic defense. But there's another occult agenda that most of the pundits are not aware of, which is to superheat the ionosphere. Did you know, for instance, that the ozone layer, the hole in the ozone,
mm-hmm.
was not caused by CFCs or, you know, McDonald's cartons. It was actually caused by this very thing, the superheating of the atmosphere, the ionosphere, a byproduct of that that wasn't planned, that it was so overheated that they actually caused a hole in the ozone layer, and then they try to cover it up by saying it's CFCs. The CFCs have been known as a problem for years, but, you know, the CFC molecule is three times heavier than air. It doesn't rise, it sinks. So it has been an agricultural problem, but, you know, we're talking about thousands of miles up in the ionosphere. You know, do us a favor.
All right, let's come back down to Atlantis now for a moment, Michael. These fallen angels, then, they're on the planet, they're doing whatever they're doing. There's a continent which you call Appalachia. Where do you think it was?
Well, Alan and Dallaire, who wrote the book When the Earth Nearly Died, they're the top paleontologists and geophysicists from Oxford and Cambridge. They have found it. They say that Appalachia is absolutely where the Atlantic Ocean is. It's where Atlantis was always posited to be by the ancient Grecian scholars like Plato. It was where, it's south of Greenland. It might be better to say that Appalachia encompassed what we know today to be Greenland, Iceland, Siberia, England and Ireland, and even the Arctic, a massive continent, most of which has now sank beneath the oceans. But Ireland and England survived. And by the way, in ancient Celtic mythology, England and Ireland, especially Ireland, have always been called the Fortunate Isles or the Blessed Isles because they survived the flood. Because one thing we didn't mention in the first part of our conversation was that the destruction of Tiamat being an ocean planet, actually precipitated not only the other events that we were talking about of cataclysmic proportion, but it also precipitated the first flood, the great flood of ancient times. I've found, and my work stresses this, was caused by the destruction of Tiamat. The water was falling in from the skies. That's what all the mythology says. And that's right. It was the ocean planet. There was actually very little physical ocean on our planet prior to the destruction of Tiamat. There was only one ocean on our planet, and it was in Russia. The Black Sea and the Caspian Sea are its remnants. But the vast oceans of Tiamat poured into our atmosphere and became the great oceans that we know today.
You know what? That's very possible, too. And I've heard this from a couple other researchers that
they believe. This is all legitimately proved, yeah. This is all scientifically backed up. You know, I do not say a thing that is just off the top of my head. This is all from source material, and I'm happy to share it with anyone if they have the book or they don't. This is all there, and it needs to be discovered because the history of our planet, the history of the world, is the most fascinating of all subjects.
Okay, so they create Atlantis. They get to Appalachia. They decide there's a region there on this continent they like. They turn it into Atlantis. What kind of technology did they have then, Michael?
Well, obviously very sophisticated. Anybody who can, you know, come through space, and of course there's even thought that they may have used the sun as a sort of a portal to come through. The sun is, of course, an event horizon. That has not been proven. So we're talking about tremendous skill here. And they did have flying crafts, pretty much like in the old Superman movies where you see, you know, just think of what we're being told through the movies. Who is Superman? What does he do? He's a being from another planet who's got tremendous sophisticated powers. He has this mysterious cavern, right, in the Arctic, in the north, with full of crystalline computers and technology, you know. He wonders about himself because he has these tremendous clairvoyant powers and so forth and so on. So, yes, it's this type of superhuman types of beings who had tremendous powers, and they were taken for gods. They could knit bones. They could show you where water was beneath the desert. They could. They spoke in weird tongues. And when people asked them, where are you from, they would point to the distant stars, you know, as their origin. These beings walked the planet, and their descendants are still busy in the planet today.
Fascinating. Well, this group then, they have Atlantis. With all their technology, with all their great minds, couldn't they predict that some kind of major earth change was going to sink them?
You see, when you are being pursued as basically a criminal, you don't know. And, of course, this planet was totally foreign to them. They had no idea about its human waves, the ultraviolet light, the size of the planet. They had not even the time to do the research to find out what kind of planet this was before this travesty happened, and they did not know that it was going to happen. So, yeah, they were pretty much victims in a way.
What kind of gifts did they leave us, if anything? What kind of knowledge?
Yeah, this is the thing that, especially since they crossed their DNA with us, we inherited a great deal of their technological expertise. I mean, hasn't it been asked many times, why is it that our technological advancement is so far in excess of our emotional and psychological advancement? That's part of the legacy. That's ability. I'm not darning technology, you know, but the point is that it's so far in excess of other things that we need here we are damaging and destroying our own planet, our own mother. It's like if you saw somebody lasering, you know, the branch upon which they're sitting, you'd half want those people to fall to teach them the lesson. You know, it's that dumb. So we have technology, yeah, and we have the ability to do great things, but are we using it properly? We can split the atom, but we can't feed the hungry, you know. This is the kind of thing that irritates me a lot.
Did they create Atlantis from the get-go, Michael, or did they do that after they intermingled with humans?
Pretty much that was their first operation, is to immediately build their own bastion so they would have security and so forth. And then I think subsequently, in a sort of a Planet of the Apes type scenario, then they began to corral individuals. And, of course, it was to their benefit that they would be taken for gods. So when they wanted to woo the people of the Earth and corral them at Atlantis and do experiments on them and check them out, they being taken for gods and bringing people to this enormous, incredible citadel of Atlantis, that worked wonders, you know, for people's awe, in the same way as, you know, Middle Ages, people going into the great cathedrals and churches would really, you know, just be humbled by that.
The visitors then decided to genetically interfere, alter Earth inhabitants.
Yeah,
they had, I guess, the kind of technology and equipment to do that.
Right, and this is what distinguishes them then, where you can actually say that these individuals were negative beings, you know, or, and you can use the word evil now, because this action definitely was immoral, was illegal. I mean, this is worse than illegal immigration. This is coming to somebody else's planet and breaking all their rules, you know, and totally tweaking and changing. And this transgenic experimentation, we are still living the consequences of that, because we are schizoid by nature. My book deals with, and my talk at ConspiracyCon tomorrow is going to be very much on the origins of evil. And the origins of evil, which I've studied all my life, I've been fascinated with evil and how it came in and why human beings are so unbelievably cruel. And we've had many conversations in this world, you know, both seriously and humoristically, about what it is that actually divides human beings from the primates and from other animals. Well, I don't think people really want to hear the answer to that. The answer is pretty dire. The answer is because man is the only sadist, the only cruel person who preys upon even his own species and even gets enjoyment from doing it. You only have to turn on the news today and see what's going on in our world to know that. And then we have the soft evil in our own lives, the questions of morality that we have even in our domestic and intimate circle of life. You know, so we have this proclivity inside of ourselves, which the religious people say is in conflict with our so-called good side. But I have tracked this particular schizoid nature back to the original tweaking of our DNA. It's not Mother Nature that causes these kinds of proclivities to exist in our life. It is the constant tweaking and interference with nature's laws that does it. So who did that?
Well, yet some humans, Michael, probably most, are good, heartwarming
right.
People. They care. Why aren't they this way? I mean, there's no doubt about it. Some humans are violent, they're evil, despicable, quite frankly. Right. How come some are, some aren't?
Because of conditioning. There was an event that took place. The very first creature that the Atlanteans created after they had done this transgenic experimentation, when they crossed their DNA with our ancestors, a certain individual was created, a Mark I child, that I refer to in the book as Homo Atlantis. Now, this remarkable being had both alien DNA, so he had all the technological and scientific skill of the visitors from other worlds, but he also had the spiritual component, you see, of the Earth. He had the moral sensibility, he had connection to the matrix. He had what we would call soul, that the other that their masters did not have. Now, these individuals decided, because they were fully intelligent, decided at some point not to continue the status quo and not to continue serving their Atlantean masters. So to cut a long story short, what they did was they left Atlantis and moved to another continent called Oceania, that we know better as Lemuria, and started their own thriving civilization. And that was a civilization, to answer your question, George, that was based on harmony, you know, love, respect of nature, and the higher principles. And the Lemurians were the ones who thought that slowly over time you could condition out the alien gene, or at least make it serve humanity. So the people that you're speaking about, and that includes, of course, the great poets and artists and musicians and the humanitarians who are doing great work in the world, I believe they do have the alien DNA, but they are maybe descendants of the Lemurian race who had this, they were much more sensible, and they tried to weed out and condition out of them this particular gene. But of course, we have the same individual who can be, you know, as we know, the great creative minds of the world had a very dark side. You can't have genius in this world without almost having a very dark side. So these things do go together in most people of the world. It just takes the right sort of circumstance to bring it out.
And then do we also have human beings who have what I would just say pure human DNA? They were not genetically altered.
No.
Their family had never been?
No, unfortunately.
So it's all of us, yep. In some form or fashion.
As far as I'm aware, every human being that exists on the planet today, and I could be wrong because these are huge subjects, very hard to track, but in my humble researches, all I've found is that every human being is either has both forms of DNA. The only maybe variable is whether or not they have a more of a Lemurian strain and background, or whether they're more of the Atlantean blood type. You know? And remember, the Atlantean warlocks kept meticulous records of their descendants, so a lot of the people that are in control of the world today and who exist behind the secret societies and who are moving society ever towards this tragedy that is coming, looming for us, these individuals, actually, a lot of them even know that they're connected to these ancient gods.
What an incredible theory, Michael. If it's true.
It's all there in the mythologies.
It is remarkable.
Yeah, it's all there in the mythology.
You said something before the break about serpent people. Explain that.
Well, the serpent people is just a name that they got. It's not because they look like serpents.
This is
a theory that gets, a lot of disinformation. The serpent was given to them because they were masters of DNA. In the ancient time, it's very hard for most of your listeners probably to even grasp the idea that the ancients even understood the mysteries of DNA, but let me assure you, they absolutely had this type of technology. Well, we know now that when you see the DNA helix, or the DNA spiral, it has the appearance of, it looks like a serpent. It's serpentine-like. That's exactly the same reason why the medical and pharmaceutical professions use the caduceus of Hermes, which is the two twin serpents, because
sure.
For thousands and thousands of years, the DNA helix was never shown as it is today on commercial TV, like some sort of Lego set, floating in hyperspace. That's not the way the DNA was known in ancient times. In ancient times, when you wanted to talk about or show or portray the DNA helix, this remarkable phenomena, you always showed it as a staff with two intertwining serpents, or you often showed it as a tree. So when you hear in the Bible, the tree of life, let not man eat off the tree of life, as my book reveals, this was a euphemism for saying, let's prevent our descendants from having this technological knowledge. That's what it actually means, and the descendants were prevented from having the knowledge that their forefathers had.
The stories we've heard about the Garden of Eden and things like that, did they occur or were they manipulated?
It's hard to say. To me, they occurred. Not in the same way as they say the Bible relates, of course, because that's a real contortion that one is. But as Lawrence Gardner and others have pointed out, that is merely a re-scripting of some very old Egyptian and Sumerian myths. And the further you go back in time, the more real they become. In every mythology, they talk about the fall of man. They talk about the schism that he has in his nature, that he falls out of favor, and that the gods are wrathful, and so forth and so on. So, yes, these things are partly metaphor about inner spiritual dynamics, but they're also clever portrayals about things that actually took place physically.
Take a moment before the top of the hour, Michael, just to tell us about the book Atlantis. Where can you get it?
Actually, the book is still only available through me and Hidden Mysteries. People just go straight onto my website. It's very easy. Or just give me a call. I have a number. They can order the book through me. This book is very controversial, so I've had to make sure that, no other chefs are in the brew, as they say. And people can easily get it from me. They can call me at 206-527-2968. They'll be instructed how to do that. Or if you have access to the Internet, on my own website, which is taroscopes.com, as you said, there's an Atlantis page there. They can do it by credit card. But, the mailing address is on the website, and the mailing address, if you call the number that I gave you, 527-2968, we make it very easy, and all the instructions are there.
Okay, that number again, 866-985-2933. Fascinating book. And when we come back at the top of the hour, Michael Tesserian talks about four particular outcomes which could occur in the future. Let's talk with him about that and much more. He even believes Hillary Clinton will be the next president of the United States. Why? We'll be back.
Get it in writing with the After Dark Newsletter. Subscribe by calling 1-888-727-5505. Somewhere deep below the earth, this is Coast to Coast AM with George Norrie.
And with our guest Michael Tesserian, and we're going to be talking about some particular outcomes for the future and a number of other issues right here on Coast to Coast AM. Welcome back, Michael. Let's talk about some of the four particular outcomes which may occur that you write about in the future. What are some of them?
Exactly. Well, I mean, there could be more than four, but the ones that I've been looking at, if the first one is the most alarming, of course, because if, in fact, the progeny, the descendants of the Nephilim do find a way out through the Stargate, then, you know, I personally think, given their deeds so far in the last 30,000 years, that these people have never loved our planet. They've never really wanted to be here. They don't like us, and they have no love for their veritable prison. After all, the Earth has been a prison to them. What might they do by way of their sophisticated technology, their microwave technology, and what have you? And, you know, as we know, criminals normally don't like to leave, you know, fingerprints. So the first outcome is, if they do in fact find a way out of the Stargate, they have not done that up until now, and they do give us updates a lot through the through the movies and the films. There's incredible stuff being shown right now that's just, would, you know, we could do a whole show just talking about what they're showing on television right now in the way of symbolic updates. You know, that's a very, very alarming concept. The second one is that they have contingents within their own group. That's how I came up with these four, is because they have different contingents, different lieutenants, working on each of these four, just in case.
Okay, and in these four outcomes that you're giving us, you developed them, you found them?
They're synthesis. Okay. They're synthesis of what I think that has been happening, just by, again, symbolically looking at what they're feeding us over the media and in different kinds of books and other ways. The second one is the fact that they realize once and for all that they cannot leave, that this barrier, even though it is part technology, part etheric energy, up until now, you see, they've thought that whatever technology could put up, technology could take down, and they've basically subjugated the whole of the Earth. A lot of the concepts of empire that you keep hearing people talk about in the history books about empire and what empire is all about, and they do accept that empire is about the resources of other countries. Well, yes, but why would a little country like England in the 1500s start stretching its tentacles out to the whole of the world to subjugate Africa, to subjugate America, to subjugate India? You see, they needed the resources. They needed the resources to move technology forward to the point where they could be doing all of this. Now, if they realize finally that it's not going to work, no matter what they do technologically, they can't find the key, and all the Paul Allens and all the Bill Gates and all the other people that they put onto this plan, they're just not able to come up with it. You know, the Russians behind the Cold War during the time of the, you know, the wall, and the Russians were busy working at this day and night, and they have not found a way through. Then the second outcome is that they start just coming out into the open and ruling with unmitigated tyranny. They're almost doing that now, as a matter of fact. But this would be a real sort of, you know, free Jack, Judge Dredd type of situation in which there's no point hiding anymore. There's no point, you know, nobody in the research community will be talking about hidden masters and hidden persuaders and the secret government, because they're all going to be out in the open, you know, basically, the way I saw it in the streets of Belfast. You know,
it won't be a secret anymore.
It won't be a secret. They'll operate pretty much in the open. And with that will come the loss of all the privileges, because realizing that now they just need to be emperors of the world, you know, better to reign in hell than serve in heaven kind of concept, then what's the point of us all having jobs? I mean, right now they're pulling up the ladder of the middle class right now as we speak. You know, we're pretty much in the final stages of something right now as we speak. The next countdown to the next 10 years to the Mayan end date of 2012 looks pretty bleak from where a lot of people are standing, you know, and that's coming from an optimist. But the point is that, you know, there's going to be a lot of changes very rapidly. In the next 10 years, it's going to seem like 100 years is encapsulated in just a single year. So, and if these individuals decide that it's just not working and they can't get out of here, they will rule this planet with unmitigated tyranny that even Hollywood, with all its guile, could not demonstrate to us. It'll be something really horrific to see.
Well, let's go back. Well, how does this all equate with these fallen angels? How do they tie into this?
Because, George, the people that are behind the thrones of government and religion are the descendants of these individuals. And this is part of my research, just like it was with Eustace Mullins, Jordan Maxwell, is to expose these individuals. And we have, all of us, Jordan has also realized that the machinations, the governments and the political systems that exist are not recent phenomena. There's an occult history of the world, there's an occult history of Ireland, there's an occult history of Africa, there's an occult history of America, there's an occult history of the world, and we see it in the modern milieu, right? What we see, sort of the machinations of politics, but these things have their roots in the ancient past. That's why the royal family, for instance, the royals of the world, and even some of your presidents I'm seeing with alarm, walk on the red carpet. That red carpet, by the way, is symbolism. It's symbolism for the bloodline connection. You know, 34 American presidents are absolutely directly bloodline connected to the royal dynasties of England. That means the Habsburgs, the Hanoverans, the Black Venetians. We have a direct connection. You know, the Venetians previously were the Phoenicians. The Phoenicians are the high Semites coming out of Babylon and Sumeria. There's a tremendous connection. I have a new book coming out called The Origins of the Illuminati and the New World Order, going in to something I couldn't cover in the Atlantis book, which is another fascinating tie-in with Egypt and how the secret societies, how Egypt plays into all of this, and why the Illuminati and the Freemasons use some of these Egyptian symbolism that you see all over America and on the American $1 bill. And all over the American milieu, you keep seeing Egyptian symbolism.
All right, let's save that for another show, Michael.
Yeah, we definitely have to do that on another show.
That is, we're going to run out of time if we have to get into that right now.
That's right.
As well. Okay, so let's review just a little bit before we move forward here with these fallen angels then. Because you've got to bring in religion in one respect. Was there a misinterpretation of all the religions on this planet based on these fallen angels? Because so many of them are so biblical-minded that they think that this was a godlike situation.
Yeah.
Obviously,
yeah,
it was not, based on your work and research and some of the other people.
No, but you see, like they said, if an engine works well, it works like magic. Well, imagine the people who create those machines. Imagine the abilities of these people to the humble... the ancient people that I'm talking about are not the people, our ancestors are not the ancestors we're taught about in school. They're not the primitive Neanderthals and all of that. That's a total rubbish. And that's luckily, and I'm happy to see that that is being refuted now by great scholars like Michael Cremo and Richard Milton and so on. But you see, as advanced in their own way, our ancestors, how much more advanced were these visitors, you know, basically coming in spacecraft, flying all through the planet. All the tumult in the heavens, the war of the gods, was actually perceived by our ancestors. So these individuals were taken for the gods.
What happened to all their technology?
All right, this is
spacecraft. Where'd it go?
That is the central question, and it's also the question that distinguishes my work from everybody else's work in this. What you've asked goes to the nub of why there's a difference between my work and, say, Zachariah Sitchin or any of the other researchers in this field. This is because, remember I was saying to you earlier that the Homo Atlantis, the first creation of the Atlanteans, they decided to move and set up their own civilization on Lemuria?
Yes.
Well, after these servants had left, the Atlanteans had nothing, they could not do anything but go back to the drawing boards to create a second progeny, a Mark II type of being, a Mark II slave to serve them. This being, we know today as the Adamic human being, that the Bible refers to as Adamic. That word comes from somewhere and it means something. This was a dumbed down version, you know, of the first version. And after the Lemurians realized what their masters had done, meaning that the Lemurians on Lemuria knew that their masters had gone back to the drawing board to create another dumbed down animal.
Okay.
A humanoid that would serve them. The Lemurians interfered. They sent agents back into Atlantis to talk to the Adams and to the Eves to seduce them away to Lemuria, saying, you know, you don't have to be servants here. We were servants once, and we saved ourselves, and we're here your cousins. We're your genetic cousins. Why don't you come with us, you know, and you can be free from all of this. And this exodus precipitated the War of the Gods, which happened about 13,500 years ago. The Atlanteans, finding out that they had been snubbed, that their slaves had been seduced away, unleashed a war. Basically, the ancient mythologies are clear about this. They initiated a global nuclear war on the Lemurians, who responded in kind. Now, the ferocity of this war was so intense that it basically irradiated the moisture in the atmosphere of the Earth, and it caused untold cataclysm far in excess of the first flood. And one of the things that War of the Gods caused was the pole shift. So to answer your question, we're cutting a lot in short here, of course,
sure,
because we're on radio and we have a short period of time. The fact of the matter is that the global war that took place between these contingents, which is recorded in every single mythology of the world, bar none, precipitated violence on Earth. And the Earth responded by a polar shift. Now, this does not necessarily mean that the poles shifted over, you know, 180 degrees or anything like that. Even the smallest movement of the polar axis would just cause untold devastation on the planet, which it is known to have done. And that is why the continents of Atlantis and Appalachia and Tyrrhenia and Beringia and so many others sank beneath the waves, and that is the answer to your question. That's where their technology went. The gods, again, did not know this was going to happen. They did not know that their violence would cause Earth to respond in violence. And, of course, the continents are in upheaval, and a great mass, almost all of their technology, not all of it, but most of it, of their technology was destroyed in that. So here we have these super advanced technological beings left stranded and pretty much naked themselves. And this is why there's been a delay, in fact. Why do you think that this, what we're talking about, after all, happened, what, 11, 13,000 years ago? How come we're still talking about it? How come that the conclusion, you know, wasn't done in the past times? It's because there was a variable that prevented the conclusion of this particular drama. That conclusion, that variable was the polar shift of the Earth, which prevented these individuals from doing what they wanted because their technology was removed. And ever since, they've been literally manipulating the flow of history, pushing mankind forward in the most brutal and sadistic manner so that they can rebuild the technology somewhat, you know, same as what they had before. And you know something? They're very, very, very close to that.
They may be. Now, are you saying, though, that the old technology is lying on the bottom of the sea?
Yep, of course it is, and they dig it up all the time, and then, as Michael Cremo's books will show you, and many other scholars have shown this, then they put it before you as some sort of, you know, artifact, and bury it away, you know, in some Indiana Jones-type way, and just lie through their teeth about it. But Richard Hoagland has exposed this, Michael Cremo has exposed this, Graham Hancock has exposed this, and there's many people in previous centuries who have also written on this. Of course that technology exists, it's absolutely a fact, but they did, you know, it's like your old Western gunfighters here. If the gun is taken away from the gunfighter, he feels naked, right? Well, think how naked you feel when you have the technology that these beings had. So they were desperate, and they were literally stranded here. They had a few pieces here and there of their technology, enough to do some primitive genetic experiments with it, and that's where the reptilian concept comes in. for people who are fascinated by that and haven't had that properly explained to them and thinking reptilians come from outer space, that is not true. The reptilians were another group, because remember, these people had the Adamic race and the Lemurians not serve mm-hmm. them and move away, so they still wanted servants later on after the pole shift. When the semblance of normality came back to the planet, they went back to the drawing boards, but they didn't have as much technology in the later age after these devastations, and therefore they crossed their DNA with certain animal life forms.
Oh my, so they turned him into a reptile.
Right, and that's where you get the Minotaur and the Centaur and the Unicorn and the dragon beings, and that is where you get the reptilians. They're the Mark III being, and they had no human DNA at all. These had alien DNA, which is humanoid, and they had animal DNA.
Okay, what happened to them? Where's that species?
As
now?
Many of your guests have definitely talked about it, and John Rhodes is an authority on this, they still exist. Remember, like in any child that is born, you can have a very reptilian-looking child, and you can have almost a pure human-looking child, but it's reptilian.
So also these reports, let's say, of Mothman or Chupacabras or
that's
things.
That's where it's all coming from.
And Bigfoot. Do you think that's
yep.
what these are, these creatures?
Undoubtedly, every single phenomenon like that is part of this genetic. It's a throwback, or it's part of the genetics that was and is a Hollow Earth concept. In the book, I go into the Hollow Earth and how that ties into this particular event. And by the way, a lot of the births today, like the Siamese twins and the freaks and all the things that exist in the backwards of mental institutions, as some of your listeners probably know about this, a lot of this, which is, again, put before us in some sort of, you know, sad, tragio-comedic way. By the way, why were the Nazis so fascinated with that and so fascinated with, racial throwbacks and all of that kind of thing? Because a lot of the mishaps of the past, we find them again today in the bizarre births that occasionally people have. All sorts of, there's a whole sub-study of that as well. But yes, you're right, and mythology is filled with the hybrid beings, Celtic mythology most of all. That's how I actually got onto this, is because through the Celtic mythology, they leave you no doubt that such hybrid beings did exist.
Was there any pure Nephilim blood left even today, or is it all gone now?
This is the key point that brings us right up to date. You couldn't have asked a better question, because that brings us right to the modern age. A couple of years ago, when I first started working on this book, George, my answer would have been no. But now my answer is, in fact, yes. Of course, the original pure-blooded alien beings live for a very long time, but of course they do die. Some estimates say that they live about 700 years.
Okay.
However, there's another aspect to this, which is going to be pretty, pretty scary in a way. In order to bypass death through a very elaborate process that involves genetics and other scientific processes, some of these beings, just before they die, can be put into a suspended animated state. I have now discovered that some of these original beings, I don't know how many of them, but it ties in with other research I've done involving geomancy and archaeoastronomy, are actually buried on the earth. And they're in a state of what you might call suspended animation, for want of a better term.
From 30 to 50,000 years ago?
Yes. And one of the, and I know some of the spots where these beings are, because I've made it a life study. It is not a pleasant study, by the way. I don't do this because I have nothing better to do. It's just one of the things that you have to study when you look into these things. And some of these beings are buried in a rock. And that is the reason, the real reason, because it has nothing, if anyone who's out there who's still in the sound of my voice thinks that the reason why the vanguard of the West is over there because of some sort of terrorist threat, or because there's oil and money to be had, are in la-la land. Because the people that we are talking about who control the world have been billionaires from the first centuries A.D. Granted, some of their lower henchmen at the bottom of the pyramid might be turned on by all that power, money, and oil, but believe me, that is not what makes the world go round. There's other occult reasons, much infinitely more sinister, which ties into why all the museums over there were ransacked and robbed, and why sacred artifacts were taken away, and why what those sacred artifacts would be being used for. It ties into the dates of why the war was initiated in those times, and why in Afghanistan, because there's things buried underneath Iran, Iraq, and Afghanistan that these individuals want to move in some sort of X-Files type way and resuscitate. Well, you can't do that if Saddam Hussein and his gang is looking over your shoulder, can you? If the country is sovereign. So what do? You obliterate those countries so that you can go in there and work unmolested to raise the dead, to raise these undead. because we have something coming here which I refer to as the Antichrist. I know what the Antichrist really is. And this, these pure-blooded Nephilim, because, and the reason why they're raising them, by the way, is because they haven't found the key to get out of the Stargate. So in a final solution type scenario, they're thinking if we could raise our original masters, they don't want to do it, but they're forced to do it because time is short. There's a countdown that the Maya were talking about, a countdown to the 2012 where these individuals are not going to have the luxury to rule the world as tyrannously as they've been doing because some other spiritual force is coming in to take care of business. So these people are on the move in order to try and vacate this planet as fast as they can. And one of the ways that they've decided to do that is to now go to the places where these underground cavernous graves are and to open them and resuscitate these individuals through a genetic process that involves the DNA.
What do you think the Nephilim, if we were able to find them, the, you know, those that are in this suspended state, what do you think they look like?
Pretty much they're taller than us. They're meant to, according to many legends, including the Celtic, they're meant to be actually quite handsome. There's reports of great ugliness, but there's also reports of incredible beauty. This is where the whole idea of Lucifer, the son of the morning, the most handsome of the angels, comes from. Celtic mythology backs that up. The head of the demonic race in Ireland's mythology was the most beautiful of all men. In fact, today, when you, in Ireland you speak of, in Gaelic, when you speak of the word beautiful, you actually use the word for the fallen angel.
Oh, well, stay with us then. Back in a moment on Coast to Coast AM with our guest, Michael Tesarian.
Get daily automatic MP3 downloads of tonight's show and every night show with the new Coast to Coast AM podcast. Log on to coasttocoastam.com. Gateway to the West. This is Coast to Coast AM with George Norrie.
You know, there was a time, some of the things that I hear tonight, I'd say, okay, let's take Michael and put him in a room and lock him up and throw away the key. Not anymore. A lot of things he says makes a lot of sense. A lot of sense indeed. So we'll be back with him. We're going to take some fast blast questions for the rest of this half hour. And the next hour, we'll open up the phone lines, give you an opportunity to chat with him. By the way, thank you so much again for the continuing support of children through Children International. It just continues to grow as we creep toward our goal of 500 children. So those of you who can afford the $18 a month, which is just 60 cents a day to sponsor a child, please do so. There are a couple ways to do it. There is a toll-free number, 1-800-869-9863. 1-800-869-9863, or you can go to the coasttocoastam.com website. On the left-hand side, click the yellow flashing banner, and that'll take you right to the website, and you can sponsor a child that way, too. You'll be very, very happy when you do that. Believe me, it just changes you somewhat. And let's just continue doing. If, you know, we can get 20 to 40 people a night to continue to sponsor, we'll hit our goal, we'll go way over it, and everybody will be happy. Back in a moment. Michael, I've got to ask you this, with these fallen angels, does that include Lucifer? I mean, was he among this group?
Yeah, the original prototype of that concept is none other than the leader of the Nephilim who came here, who decided that when the mating with the female, Earth females, didn't work, that turned out to be something, you know, worse than Rosemary's Baby, so they decided to genetically interfere. It was his idea, that being's idea, and, you know, I hope that the beings that we're talking about that are interred under the Earth, you know, that's not the one. But, you know, either way, even if it's another one of these beings that were interred in the Earth. Now, Celtic mythology, British mythology, anyone who's really done their homework with Welsh mythology knows that, you know, they talk about Cronus being chained for 1,000 years. In the Book of Revelation, you hear about the bottomless pit and that the angels of darkness are bound for a time, that, you know, and I think it's Revelation that talks about those who were not, who are not, but who will again. I have a DVD coming out that's a companion to the Atlantis book in a very short time, within a couple of weeks. In fact, I have 6 DVDs coming out, and one of them is a companion to the Atlantis book that goes a lot more detail into this concept of the interred ones and the fallen angels. And you're absolutely right. There's no doubt about it that that prototypical concept of the, you know, a bona fide Luciferian principle has some antiquity in history, yeah.
So what about archangels? We've heard, you know, Michael the Archangel, Gabriel. Who might they have been?
These are, again, you know, I believe that there's the concepts of the angels is a physical thing. Like Jordan Maxwell, I'm totally convinced that when people talk about angels, they were speaking about physical types of individuals. And the great scholar L.A. Waddell in the previous century did a lot of work on the archangels to discover that, again, these were heroes originally, individuals caught up in the great battles of the gods that later, you know, were, I mean, these beings were literally so great, literally the men and the women who fought on the battlefields with physical swords, and that later on there were their names, or the corruptions of their names, entered into the religious canon and into mythology as some of the angels, you know.
You know, Michael, I've always believed that this happened on this planet, and it was going on within the universe.
Yeah.
And here comes the question that a lot of people are going to be asking later on, I'm sure. So let's see if we can get an answer from you on this one as well. There's no question that regardless of what these are, these beings, these fallen angels, what have you, that it doesn't really take away from the belief system of a creator. If anything, it might enhance it. However, all the stories that we read, a lot of the Bible, the Quran, everything talks and makes reference to a creator, to a God. Do you think this helps it or it minimizes a God when we talk about fallen angels as extraterrestrials?
That's a great concept. I have, you know, a whole other, literally, you know, a library of information to answer that. But what I tried to do in the Atlantis book was to steer away from the obviously metaphysical. I am a metaphysician. I work in the divination arts, and I come from a long line of people who were philosophers, and I have my own personal answers to that. Because I felt that what I was trying to communicate through the book was so absolutely of practical importance to people that they imminently must know what's going on in order to make sense of the world around them, of the political milieu, that in order, and I've had discussions with some of your other guests on this and other people who email me from all around the world asking those questions about the nature of evil and how the Nephilim even became evil themselves and what this means for, you know, religion and spiritual teachings. you know, I would love to discuss that, but again, I put the emphasis on the factuality of it because it's very easy to get, you know, lost into the abstract here. That's what, in fact, in one way, that's what we've done too much of. We've got so lost into the abstractia and into the sort of the metaphysical conundrums, which are fascinating as they may be, but that has also served, George, to blind us to the actual, you know, the scripture, right, to the actual factuality of a lot of the stuff that's been happening there, that it's written in the book of Genesis, that's written in the Deuteronomy, that's written in the book of Job. You know, yes, there are poetic, there's philosophical, there's metaphysical meaning to be drawn from that, and people are specialists in that, and I love that subject, and I've studied it my whole life. And I have a lot to say about it, but I have had a great job as an editor of my own work in order to decide, you know, shall we go on this sort of tangent here, you know what I mean? Or shall I keep it topical in this instance because this is the most important thing to realize, a very standard story.
All right, but you're not dodging the question now, are you?
No. I mean, you know, I am dodging it in a way because I take those kinds of questions so damn seriously.
Sure.
About religion and God.
But do you believe in a creator then, based on the things you've learned about fallen angels?
I definitely do believe in a higher intelligence, absolutely.
Okay.
No doubt about it.
I also
believe that we are going to have that intelligence very much operating in our life from 2007 onwards. We are now living in the times where anyone who maybe would say no to that question, like we meet many people in the world who have decided that there is no higher intelligence in the world, well, those guys are going to be in for one hell of a shock because in the next 10 years, in fact, from the Maya countdown, it was 13 years countdown to 2012, so that brings it back to 1996, right? Because from 1996 to 2012, you got 13 years. Well, we're halfway past that already. And in my astrological calculations, which are about America but also about the world, anyone who's out there who thinks there is no higher intelligence is going to be in for a mighty big shock because that intelligence is going to be directly involved in earth affairs very, very soon, and in a way that is perhaps not expected by a lot of people.
The giants, were the fallen angels giants, Michael? How big do you think they might have been?
That's something I go into in the book and also in the DVD. It's amazing. Some people estimate that some of these people were about 18 feet tall, and I'm not joking there. There was thigh bones alone have been found that were 8 feet tall. Just the thigh bones.
God.
I've got all this information in the book. There's websites on it. On my links page, people will find some interesting, if they go to Taroscopes and go onto the links page, you'll find whole sections on the giants. I've got information on that in my book. Oh, it's unbelievable. Yeah, the giants is not an outlandish term. By the way, remember I talked about the war of the gods?
Yes.
And that the war was an atomic nuclear war?
Yes.
A lot of scholars, and I'm one of them, I do believe that the giantism factor may have been caused by the radioactive fallout from that war. It may have been at least a contribution.
All right, so you don't think they were giants from the get-go?
I actually do, because that's what the legends say. Whatever the legends say, I kind of am a sucker, I believe it. So, you know, the legends do say that these people were of immense stature, but we must also factor in another dimension, which Lana Cantrell, one of the great American scholars in this field, talks about, that she is a believer in her book that, yes, it was also the radio fallout that created certain colorations of the skin. You know how the gods were always said to be blue in their skin tone, or they might even been pied, multicolored, all sorts of weird anomalies that we find about the gods, that some of them had three eyes, and all the rest of it. This, she said, was caused after the fact by the fallout. So there's a lot of interesting, a lot of interesting tie-ins there.
What about the Greek gods, Michael? What do you think those beings were? Were they also extraterrestrials? Were they the fallen angels, or were they a different group?
I think they are pictorializations of what we're talking about, because the Greeks didn't invent those gods. Zeus comes from the old Adonai, Jupiter concept from before. So every single one of the gods either came out of Egypt or Samaria from before. It's all descended by, in fact, many of the scholars have discovered, like Alexander Del Mar has discovered and L.A. Waddell has discovered, that most of the Greek and Roman gods can directly be linked back to the Brahmin gods of India. So they're much more old than that, and absolutely, the Western gods, the Western archetypes are, in my opinion, remember, what do they all have in common? They're wrathful, they're vengeful, they infight, you know? They have contempt for everyone beneath them. Yep, these are old motifs. No matter where you go, you find it.
Okay, if these fallen angels, if they were around 30 to 50,000 years ago, and they lived 700-800 years, obviously, the pyramids, they say, were built let's say 10,000 years ago. That's a number that I feel pretty comfortable with.
Right, me too.
Do you think the descendants of these fallen angels, the Nephilim, helped build the pyramids with some kind of technology?
Yep. Some of these great monolithic sites, I specialized in that for many years. This another one of the beloved subjects. I believe that they can fall into two basic categories. Those monuments that were built before the flood and the pole shift, and those that were built afterwards. Now I believe that certain scientists are catching up with this. They've discovered watermarks on the Sphinx, for instance, and they know that the Sphinx was definitely pre-deluge. It's much older than the pyramid, and the pyramid, because it's more pristine, was after the pole shift and so on. So, yeah, and there's no doubt about it that the gods built these. However, one thing, these were not so much tombs as we would understand it in today's world, in the sense that, you know, you bury somebody and then you build something over them. I think they were used for that to a certain extent, but the ancients had a peculiar way of doing things. When one of these, and remember, we're talking about the Lemurians also being gods and also living for a long period of time, so you have two contingents who are very, very powerful beings, one who are pretty dark and evil, and the other group are actually beings of great power and light. Well, when any of these serpent people died, they're, you know, the people who lived on would try to commemorate their entire life in stone. So what we're seeing are not so much tombs, but cenotaphs. There's a difference. A cenotaph is something that is a commemoration in stone of a person's entire life. It's like what, you know, we may compose a symphony for, you know, a departed person. A symphony in music, that has been done. Like an elegy, a beautiful elegy. Well, that is what the ancients used to do in stone. Now, the places of incarceration where the undead, the Nephilim, were put, they will become places, geomantically speaking, of very, very negative energy. So it's like when you go on holiday or you go traveling, and this is how I discovered this, was that, you know, you go to places where you feel just awful. You know, places like the Lebanon and Israel and the Middle East, which are filled with conflict. Places like Northern Ireland, which are just so drenched in conflict, absolutely drenched in conflict, and other areas in the world. I have tied that in my occult researches to the fact that there is therefore one or more of the graves of these negative beings there that just emits tremendously dark energy. And then there's places where you go where you feel just fantastic, you know, and there's very inspiring energy. Those are places where higher beings of the Lemurian strain fell, and they were interred there. So there's a whole sub-study of this under what's called archaeoastronomy and the positioning of these places on the earth. And now because of the satellites, they're able to pinpoint in Iraq, in Afghanistan, in the Lebanon, in the British Isles, they're able to pinpoint where these underground caverns were, because it's the Masons and the secret societies who've kept, for many, many thousands of years, they've kept the records of where these underground tombs are. But, of course, cities grow up over these tombs, you know what I mean? People don't even know what's happening 14 feet beneath the ground. It's the old H.G. Wells, you know, Journey to the Center of the Earth syndrome. We don't even know what's underneath our feet. But now, with the satellites, they can see these secret chambers underneath, and they're going to make use of those satellites to mark the spot and go in there with their teams and try to gradually disinter these beings. And, you know, it's interesting to speculate what would happen there.
David Icke writes about some human beings who have reptilian-looking eyes. I would assume they could be part of the offspring, part of the DNA manipulation.
Yeah, especially the third branch that we were talking about, where they actually did create reptilian beings. But even those reptilian mothers, and you can see this on the cave paintings, I mean, J.J. Hertak has done some incredible work on this. You see, like in any child that is born, you can have the ones who are really reptilian, I mean, scales and eyes and tail and the whole works. Well, you don't want those kind of people, you know, those kind of reptilians walking down the main street in the modern age. I do believe those beings were pretty much allowed to walk or roam the earth up until about the Middle Ages. Middle Ages mythologies, the works of J.R.R. Tolkien, for instance, and many of the ancient books that he refers to in his works, definitely these individuals were live and dangerous walking in the world. But as the modern age came in, and as city-states became the norm, you had to phase these beings out. And I think that John Rhodes is right when he says that they were interred beneath the earth, and they still exist today, and people see these beings to their great fear. Now, the reptilian who are maybe more humanoid-looking, you could be standing beside one in the street, a fully reptilian being, but because they just happen to be more humanoid, because remember, they are part alien DNA, and the alien fathers are humanoid. So unless you could not tell... Well, you can tell. You have to use your intuition. You can use your clairvoyant abilities. Of course, if anybody tells you that they think that, we look at them as if they're, you know, raving lunatics. but we don't believe anymore in this world when people tell us those things, people who are highly intuitive and people who are clairvoyant. You know, I personally come from a whole line of people like that, so it's no news to me. But in today in the world, if somebody, your child or somebody who's got highly developed clairvoyant abilities tells you, oh, mommy, I don't like that person. There's something, you know, cold-blooded about them, or they have evil energy. We force, you know, ourselves to like people, and we don't trust these intuitions. It's terrible.
Is there a possibility that these entities, you know, because ancient mythology also talked, for example, about vampires, could they be part of this?
Check. You're so on the ball, George. Check back to the old Nosferatu story, the old Dracula idea. Dracula means the dragon, the serpent, yep. The ones who drink the human blood, the human energy. I actually believe, and I'll be talking about this at Conspiracy Con, and it's in the book and the DVD, that these beings who have been interred under the earth have actually been fed. Because they're in a sort of a suspended animated state. It's not a suspended animation, but we've got to use that word so that people will understand what we're talking about here. They have actually been fed for thousands of years, and you know, but they've been fed by what? All the war, the havoc, the death, the ritual crime, the murder, the mayhem, the slaughter, the raping of the jungles, the trees, the flora, the fauna, all the debauchery that their henchmen on the surface of the planet do, and I'm including in that assassinations, serial killings, all sorts of trauma, the crap that comes over the television to put fear and into people's lives. All the human being is nothing but a kinetic battery, and we are in a whole matrix, a whole sea of fear.
So they feed on this.
Yes, they feed on it, and there's a specific way to do that. We can't go into that on this program, but there's a specific way in which this works, in which the very emotions that you are leaking from your body enter into the matrix, enter into the earth grid, and are channeled in occult rituals. The design of the cities are involved in this, the design of churches, the design of streets and city plans, the whole design of the earth. Where certain bombs are dropped, where certain assassinations are done, the sidereal astrological timing of these things is done with an occult agenda. It would open your eyes to find out about this incredible thing and make sense of some of the terrible crimes that are done to children and why they would be done. And
well,
what the hell is
going
on?
Hold on now, Michael. Hold on. What about, though, the Lemurians, who are the good ones? Aren't any of those people in suspended animation somewhere? Aren't there anybody, good people, protecting them?
I have more information, unfortunately, on the Nephilim. I'm not too sure about the machinations of the Lemurians.
Evil doesn't win this time, or does it?
Of course not. You know, we know that is not going to happen because as I said, there's going to be many changes in the next 10 years. Partly my work is a small contribution to that, to waking people up, to trying to preserve truth. You know, I'm not a priest. I'm not a pope. My job is not to go around saving human beings, but my job, as I see it, is definitely to save truth. So that truth will nourish the world in the future when humanity finally wakes up to find out, you know, exactly what's been going on. As far as the agencies of light, I have my mentors. I believe that those people were descended from, you know, the gods and are tremendous individuals, you know, who have great creative abilities and so on. And, of course, those individuals exist in the world. But, you see, we have to be armored up. The other side has got all the weaponry. The other side have got the edge on us because they know what we don't know. We have fallen asleep. We don't even believe our own ancestors, the people who cared about us the most, who walked near to us, who had our best interests at heart, who created the beautiful, you know, divination arts, who created the great citadels and churches and all the knowledge in the books. We're not reading it. We're not listening. So
all
that
right,
is
Michael.
Why we're in the state we're in.
Michael Tesserian, stay with us because the phone lines are now open. And we're going to take phone calls for you when we come right back. I'm George Norrie. This is Coast to Coast AM.
Find out more about tonight's guest. Log on to coasttocoastam.com.
be mine, my darling dear. Love you all the time. I'm just a
from somewhere deep below the earth, this is Coast to Coast AM with George Norrie. To reach George from west of the Rockies, dial 800-618-8255. From east of the Rockies, dial 800-825-5033. First-time callers may reach George by dialing area code 818-501-4721. International callers may reach George by dialing your in-country Sprint access number and pressing option 5. Then dialing toll-free 800-893-0903. This is Coast to Coast AM with George Norrie on Premier Radio Networks.
I'm just a fool.
Well, Michael also has a new website on numerology. I want to talk with him about that when we come back. We'll take your phone calls as well on Coast to Coast AM. Hey, Michael, before we get into the calls, tell me about your new website in numerology.
What's that all about? My main work is involving the divination arts, which I believe are an incredible tool. Again, you know, handed to us by our ancestors. And for those who don't know what the divination arts are, they're astrology, tarot, Kabbalah, and numerology. I have an online cyber school where we teach those, especially how they all work together. Rather than, you know, trying to learn them separately, there's an interesting way that they work together. And I've also done those classes, you know, for many, many years, hundreds and hundreds of classes in person before I had the Mystery School online and also during. And a strange thing, you know, a strange pattern of events kept happening. This website is called personaltimescopes.com. I want everybody to go and take a look at it because it's really something remarkable. But it's actually the clients and the class members are really the reason why it exists, and that is because I used to teach numerology last, you know, it was like a 10-week class, and then we do the numerology part, not because it's the least important, it's just that, you know, that one was the one at the end. And yet, time and time and time again, every time that I would do the numerology, people were jumping out of their seats because this was the one, you know, that they just seemed to light up with, where it was so easy, it was so practical. I mean, basically, if you can use a calendar or a watch on your wrist, you can use the time scopes concept, because it's numerology. Numerology is a very ancient subject. It's certainly very, very empowering. But however, if you, in the past, if you had to, you know, do the calculation to make your chart, it was quite complicated, you know, in the sense that you had to read a lot of books on it or read the books of other people with a lot of disinformation in it or take expensive classes like, you know, what I was giving at the time. What we've done right now, though, is we have created a website in which you go there and you just put in your date of birth, and basically that's it. You will be, what you will get is it will print out a chart for every single day in the year, what your special day is, meaning it'll tell you what to do, it will tell you what to expect, it will tell you, you know, what's coming around the corner and how to be empowered. The whole concept of this is to know what's coming so you can be, you know, tooled up and armored against it. And it's all based on your date of birth. That's what numerologists understand, because I want to insist that the date of birth is one of the most powerful and magical things that you're given. We were talking earlier about the divine force and God and the creator. Your date of birth, those simple numbers, are literally very magical. You can't change them, right? You can't ever change your date of birth.
You got them.
You got them. So this thing is actually a tool that has been given to you by God, but we, as usual, are not using it. We need to use it right. Numerology is the science of how to have what is literally called a personal time scope, your own personal calendar. It works exactly the same as a regular calendar, George, but it's, and I've used it all my life, and my members of the Mystery School, you know, which is worldwide now, use it. And on the Personal Time Scopes website, we already have thousands of members. You just put in your date of birth, and it will print out this incredible chart so that you know at a glance, and I mean it's at a glance. If you can use a clock or a watch, you can use this. It's so when it should say, say, the 22nd or today, right, you know, we've got the 26th. Yes, but that's the 26th for the whole of the world. What is the number for you specifically?
Mm-hmm.
And then we give you the caption and the meaning, you know, beside it so that you know what to expect, what's good on these days. Should you have your business meetings? You know, should you buy property? Should you invest? Should you go and see the doctor? Should you have surgery? You name it. There's not a thing in your life. We're just randomly out there in the sea of time, leaving ourselves wide open, you know, to the adversary. And we need, especially, why I actually put this up myself, why I decided to do it now, is because it ties into this whole thing about the Maya prophecies about what's coming in the next 10 years. And, you know, people need as many tools right now as they possibly can to gain empowerment, because there's a huge adversarial action in the world. Truth is, you know, endangered. Truth right now as we know it, as well as many of the other idioms, is in a very, very raggedy state right now. And we therefore need as many of the great ancient tools. You know, these are as close to us as our own bodily symbols. And the problem with numerology of the past was that it was, your numerology chart was aligned with the normal Christian calendar of the months, you know, just like we have the months through the year, the 12 months. So when you got a chart in the past, it was synchronized with the Christian calendar of the 12 months. Our system is properly, you know, calibrated to the astrological chart, the astrological cycles, and that makes it 100% accurate, whereas the previous ones were not. I mean, date of birth, again, so important. America, July 4th, 1776. America has the distinction in a way of being one of the only countries that has a date of birth, you know. But the date of birth is monumentally important. We're running around in the world looking for our answers, and we have this remarkable thing that the diviners of old, the people who work with astrology and tarot, they know its secret, they know its power. But now with the power of the Internet, we're able to, you know, do the work for you, basically, and just have this remarkable interface.
All right, let's go to the phones. You ready?
Oh, sure, let's do it.
Pick it up by going to our wild card line. Welcome to the show. You're on the air. Hi there.
Hi.
Hello there.
Hello. Hello.
Hi, can you hear us?
Yes, I can.
Go ahead.
Okay, I have a question for Michael. Good evening, Michael. This is Kathy from Post Falls, Idaho.
Hi, Kathy.
And hi. Nice to talk with you.
Thanks for listening.
Thank you. You had four possible outcomes, Michael, and I was listening carefully, and I thought I only got two. I wondered what the third or the fourth might be. Maybe you've already covered that. Also, about the Lemurians, I didn't quite get their genealogy and how they came about. I was wondering if you could real quickly recap on that. And also, the last 13 years from 2012, is that 1999? That we were going back to for the last 13 years, and you know, what do you see as one of the third or fourth outcomes for what we're going to go through?
Yeah, I believe the countdown, you're right. What did I say, 1996 or something? Yeah, it's 1999 is the 13-year countdown. You're right. And your other question had to do with...
two more of the events.
Oh, yeah. Well, see, the third outcome is that we, and this is a kind of a strange one. You think the other ones are strange? Check this out. This is when we do the right thing, in the sense that we, the human race, wake up, and the human race say, no more of this tyranny, no more of this overt machinations, no more of this degradation of our planet, and no more injustice. We actually do, in the modern age, in the computer age, when there's more information about these secret societies than there ever has been before, and they're being exposed daily. So the human race basically rises up to do the right thing in desperation, but the only problem is we do it in a far too radical and violent way, you know, the old way of the concept of fighting fire with fire. And our action ends up in the destruction of the earth anyway, and the destruction of mankind. It's like that old Sam Peckinpah motif where, you know, it's like light the fuse, let's take out the evil, but we sacrifice ourselves in the process of doing that. That is
as strange as it may seem, is in fact one of the outcomes, Kathy. It's not a very pleasant one. It certainly would get us the right result, though, but it would leave the world, you know, being a giant headstone floating in space.
Is anybody going to come down and save us, Michael, from above?
Well, that one, you're talking to Michael Tesarian here, so unfortunately my answer to that one is the standard one, and is that completely forget about that. Part of that quarantine, that the barrier that was put around the Earth, is tied into this concept of responsibility and karma, and the fact that when pathogenic forces enter into a body politic, just in the same way as a homeopathic doctor understands, that person must strengthen their immune system. There is to look to Flash Gordon and to look to Krishna and to look to Jesus and to angels, which is, of course, I understand why people will do that, but that is a sign of people's helplessness. The human race is more than able to heal itself if it calls on the right forces within itself, and the remedy will entirely be based on human, you know, action, the quest of knowledge, the quest of understanding, and the quest of empowering our own, shall we say, immune system, meaning our own intelligence factor. Because this is not an insurmountable problem by any means. I have always looked at this invasion of the Nephilim as an invasion of a virus or a pathogenic force. I mean, after all, isn't the Earth a beautiful, like a cell, like a beautiful cellular structure? Well, it's been invaded by something deadly. But the answer is not the slash and burn, shall we say, allopathic methodology. That never works. It doesn't work for a human being, and it certainly won't work for the Earth. It is the homeopathic remedy of strengthening our own body politic. Now, that has to be done in specific ways. I go into that in the DVDs and the books. But the fourth outcome is the right one. The fourth outcome is the most perfect of all, which is that mankind finally does discover the correct means to the end and vanquishes its enemy with no excessive loss of life or home world. We eradicate the enemy and, you know, we slay the beast, basically, and have done with it. And I believe, again, that we're coming to that conclusion within the next 10 years or so.
Michael, what do you base these theories on? Gut instinct or what's out there? What kind of proof?
No, far from it. I'm just a guy from Ireland who likes to play the guitar and smoke cigarettes and do whatever. It has nothing to do with gut instinct. This is just research, diligent research, you know, into these mysteries.
Things that you find in ancient texts and things like that?
Yeah, I think that I have a calling. It's something I know how to do. I have a lot of symbolic literacy. I'm able to look at things that appear on the surface to be very dissimilar. You know, scientists would say that I'm very right-brained, and they'd probably be right. But the fact of the matter is I have always studied occult subjects. I come from a family that's very much steeped in the metaphysical tradition, and I have a deep and abiding love for humanity, and I know that we have some very serious pathogenic forces there. It's like the old, you know, detective who knows that a serial killer is walking the streets while the whole community sleeps. That detective has got indigestion, he's got insomnia, he's sitting at the window, he can't sleep, he doesn't know whether to tell the community that they've got a madman in their midst, because that will fear everybody. But if he keeps this silence, then maybe that criminal will go out and, you know, commit more murder. So, you know, he's up there drinking his coffee all night. That pretty much describes Michael Tesarian in regards to the Nephilim and the evil that's in the world. For years I didn't know what to do. Shall I go into the public arena and, you know, explain this stuff, that we have huge amounts of criminality and we have criminals of unimaginable proportions infecting the Earth? Or shall it just stay stum and do nothing and then leave these individuals to ply their wares? Well, I chose the former, and that is to get onto the world stage. And what do I find, especially in the American context? That there's all too great interest in this. People are dying for this information. They're absolutely, totally, it's striking some chord deep inside, you know, and it's explaining disinformation, for a start. It's clearing up a lot of X factors that were not explained before. And more than that, it's actually empowering individual. You know, the Personal Timescopes website is a small part of that. Use time for yourself. Use time so that it becomes your enemy, as opposed to an enemy. So it becomes your friend, so that it's no longer passing you by. You know, all the work that I do is geared towards that type of empowerment. The Atlantis book is very much part of that.
Maybe they're literally dying for the information, huh?
I am absolutely believing that we are starving for it. We are like emaciated. We're like on life support right now. I think that the last level of the great power pyramid is in place. Only the capstone needs to be put on there by the dark force, and we're all going to be living in slavery under its shadow. Those days are coming very soon. We need to find out how to, you know, get rid of that situation, and we need to put our partisan beliefs aside. You know, I believe, for instance, you talked about Hillary Clinton. I know that in 2008, there's going to be a female president of America. I also know from my astrological insights into this matter that George Bush is going to be set up in some type of scandal. He doesn't probably know this, but he is going to be set up in some debauchery far worse than what Bill Clinton was in order to make him look like a pariah very soon so that he will be out of favor and all his changes will be out of favor. In fact, in a very few months, you're going to see a turning of the tides towards the favoritism of George Bush. But later on, down the line, probably next year, there's actually going to be some massive scandal, right?
All
I'm talking about made for the history books.
We're going to write these predictions down.
Please do, because they're coming. And, you know, I can only report what I'm seeing, and that is that there's going to be a scandal that is unimaginable proportions that's written. George Bush's code name from his own secret security guards is Temporary, okay? Heed that, Temporary. That is the president's code name.
That was his, what, Skull and Bones?
No. This is his official secret service of the White House. Know him just like they have code words for the members of the White House. George Bush's code word used by his own bodyguard is Temporary. Now, why would you use that term? At other conferences, I've heard people, we've been discussing that maybe there could be an assassination of the president. I tend to think that it's going to be more a character assassination because that will hurt him a lot. Then that will set the path for the next group to enter in, which is Hillary Clinton and her mob to come in. Because you see, the reason why I know this, partly, there's many reasons, but one of them is to do with symbolism. When you birth something, things are always birthed by the female. We have now the New World Order being birthed. But when you birth something, it must be birthed on the female symbolism. The death of England, the death of the British Isles, was birthed on Margaret Thatcher, a female, all right? America has the Statue of Liberty. America, astrologically, is born in the sign of Cancer, which is the female water sign, the mother sign. The one thing that has been missing all along is you don't have a female head of state. You're going to have that. She's already been introduced to people a couple of years back when the Clinton administration...
What about Condoleezza Rice?
Beautiful point. Condoleezza Rice is the syzygy. In mythology, you always have, and especially in Celtic mythology, you always have the twin females. You have it in the artwork of Leonardo da Vinci. You have it at the foot of the cross in the famous Calvary paintings of the Middle Ages. And you certainly have it in Celtic mythology of the dark sister and the light sister. Mythology is being played out before our eyes. In the opening of the Atlantis book, it says that some myths are about to happen. They are about to happen. Well, some of the things that we think are mythologies are actually about to happen. The pairing off of the light sister and the dark sister. Hillary Clinton, but Hillary Clinton's going to get in no matter what. But Hillary Clinton wants to get in. The Whore of Babylon is on her way. She doesn't just come in peace and harmony. The Whore of Babylon ascends to the throne, you see, under tumult, chaos, mayhem. So the previous president must go out of office in some type of massive made-for-TV, made-for-history-book scandal. That is coming. He's pretty much walking into it already.
All right, let's sit back and watch and see what happens. Let's go to our other calls. East of the Rockies, welcome to the show.
Hey, George and Michael, how you doing?
Hi.
Good, my name is Chad from Iowa.
Chad.
I'm just calling about my family here. My dad's family is Merovingians. And my mother's family is Welsh. I was just curious about, I guess, some of the things that are said about, like, my father's family, like them being Elven, Illuminati, Satan, all that stuff, and what your take is on that, and I guess the other stories where they come from. Also about the Welsh, the Egyptians, the Basques, about them being probably, like, one people a few thousand years ago, possibly the Atlanteans.
Basques are interesting, of course, because they have the Rh negative blood type.
Yeah, and A negative.
Yeah. Yeah, and the Merovingians, of course, I mean, it's a long story. A lot of people probably who's listening won't understand. If we could start talking about that, they would lose people.
No, let's keep that tight.
But certainly the Merovingians are one of these great dynasties, for people who want to know, who came from the ancient world. We talked earlier on vaguely about certain dynasties that are direct bloodline connections, and what Chad is talking about is the Merovingians are one of the most secret and most powerful of those bloodline groups who set up in France, but they're also in Italy, and he says Wales. That's very intriguing. That there's a Welsh connection there. Very interesting. There's a book called The Dragon Legacy or something like that that goes in very deeply to that. There's a magazine called Dagobert's Revenge that people can get that goes into the whole history of the Merovingians. They can look it up on the Internet. It's very, very interesting. I do talk about it in the book. The king of the Merovingians, who was called Dagobert, it's a name that comes from the word Dagon or dragon. So there's very much a serpent-dragon connection to the Merovingian bloodline, definitely, yeah.
Let's go to our wild card line. You're up on Coast to Coast. Hi.
Hi, George. With all due respect, this doesn't add up. As you know, Temporary is George Bush's fraternity name from college. And all of his numbers, like that one lady caught, don't add up. And in one minute he says things are going to be great. The next minute he says we're going to blow ourselves up. Then he says they're going to blow us up. And I would suggest an exorcism and read the Bible, because in Revelation it says there's four angels, not three, bound under the Euphrates in Iraq, who will kill 2 billion people. So
yeah, well, that's true. Back in a moment.
Sign up now for Streamlink, now with podcasting. Get it today at coasttocoastam.com. Somewhere deep below the earth, this is Coast to Coast AM with George Norrie. To reach George from west of the Rockies, dial 800-618-8255. From east of the Rockies, dial 800-825-5033. First-time callers may reach George by dialing area code 818-501-4721. International callers may reach George by dialing your in-country Sprint access number and pressing option 5. Then dialing toll-free 800-893-0903. This is Coast to Coast AM with George Norrie on Premier Radio Networks.
Hey, on our next Coast to Coast program, of course, it's our Friday into Saturday night open lines. And our first hour, we're going to be talking with an individual, calls himself Prophet Yahweh. He claims that he's got the ability to summon UFOs at will, and he plans to do that in June in Las Vegas. Now, I kid you not, there's a television station, because I've been getting fast blasts like crazy, that videotaped him doing this, and they claim that two unidentified objects popped up in the sky the moment he solicited them to show up. Now, that's weird. First hour tomorrow, we'll talk with Prophet Yahweh, and then we'll have open lines right here on Coast to Coast AM. And welcome back. Let's go right back to the phones because the clock is ticking. West of the Rockies, you're on the air. Hi there.
Hi, George. How are you?
I'm fine.
Thanks for taking my call. Sure. This is Celinda from Southern California.
Okay.
And first of all, I just want to tell you thanks so much for having David on. I saw him speak at Mother's here in Southern California, and he was wonderful on nutrition.
Mm-hmm. Oh, David Wolf.
Yes,
sure,
he was fantastic, and he's a living example of what he talks about, too.
Indeed. Thank you.
Oh, he is. Now, Michael, I have a couple of things. One that came up while we were talking, or while you guys were talking with that lady, wanting to know if someone was going to beam us up Scotty. I have not subscribed to that belief myself, but something very interesting happened a couple of years ago, and it showed up on the SOHO satellite, and I saw it before they took it off, so I know it did happen. And we had a huge flare, an X-class flare that was apparently headed straight for this planet. And there'd been an object flying around the sun for a number of weeks that they had been marking and watching. And just before this, or I guess it was, yeah, just before this flare went off, it went back around the sun. And when the flare came out, it made a right angle and went right back around in the track that that UFO took. And that makes me wonder if there really isn't somebody up there watching over us at some level anyway.
And I actually saw the footage of that. And
fascinating.
It, yeah, I saw that on the NASA before they took it off, that is.
Yeah.
And it did go at right angles. They say that the object you're talking about was as big as a planet.
Oh, actually, I heard it was something like three times the size of the Earth is what I heard.
Yeah, it was a huge edifice.
Yeah.
And it did go at a right angle, so it couldn't have been any just, you know, piece of rock floating in space. And it shot right into the sun. And I have a colleague called Nazim Haramein, who's actually a very, very great scientist, who has done much research to prove that the sun is, in fact, an event horizon, what most people would know as a black hole, and that it is, in fact, a hole through which, you know, space travel can take place, and that many of the spaceships that go, the crafts that do have this you know, super technological ability to travel in the universe, do so by way of these holes. And that is the kind of the phenomenon you're talking about.
Mm-hmm.
Is exactly that. It's the coming and going, and NASA see it all the time. They just hide the footage,
right?
And, you know, tell us all a bunch of stupid stories, which, you know, there seems to be no end to the cover stories that we're being told. So absolutely, there is definitely tremendous extraterrestrial activity up there in relationship to the sun. Did you know that the Vatican, for instance, has the rights on all the solar observatories and all the solar telescopes before the public ever hear anything regarding any types of sightings by way of a solar telescope? It crosses Vatican intelligence first.
Somewhat. I'm not surprised. Not in the least. I have a second question for you. Actually, it's I would like your opinion more than anything. I've had some interesting experiences. One occurred up in the northern states. I won't say where because I don't want to identify a person. A man was talking to me at a meeting, and he changed. He literally changed before my eyes, and he took on the face of a reptilian, complete with the slanted eyes and the mouth that went back and the elevated nostrils and the whole look. And I don't think he was aware he was doing it, but he changed before my eyes. It freaked me out so bad I couldn't talk to my husband about it. And then not too long after that, we were on a trip. We were in Gettysburg, and my husband saw it with me. A man stepped up onto a tour bus with us, and he did the very same thing right before both of us.
Well, see, you're talking about, think of it, you're talking about seeing things like this, and you're in your logical state of mind, and therefore your reason, right, can sort of keep you in check. As frightening and as disturbing as that is, and of course it will stay with you the rest of your life, and you'll want answers. Imagine for a moment all the people who, you know, for one reason or another, go on those heavy drugs like LSD, and they open they open themselves up. And what do? Apart from all the crazy stuff they do see, they also see this stuff. Okay, just the same way you did. Other people, by taking drugs and illicit substances through the years, will also see physically the things we're talking about. Not that I advocate drugs or that you should do this, but think then how lost they are. They run and tell people. Nobody believes them. Clairvoyants have been seeing this for years. People like yourself who probably have some latent clairvoyant abilities, or you maybe have done, you've been fighting this war in previous lives, so it's come across with you, you see, and you just sense the people around you. There's a multiplicity of reasons why you as an individual, you see, would have these kinds of experiences. My advice to you, if anything, is never to be freaked out by it. It's really, at the end of the day, nothing more mysterious than all the strangeness of this planet. I mean, my God, We're surrounded by things that are so incredible that really you should also try and take that with a pinch of salt and not be so traumatized. Just realize that it does come under the heading of all the bizarrities that exist in this world. But think in your own mind about all the poor unfortunates who open themselves up for one way or another, or very highly sensitive people who see this kind of thing on a daily basis and end up, you know, being locked up by their parents, you know, in lunatic asylums, or being put on drugs and medication because nothing wrong has happened to them except they've seen behind the veil of the apparent reality in the world. You know what I mean? And then we treat them and push them aside. But yeah, your experiences are pretty intense. And, you know, John Rhodes is the person that you really should read about because he catalogs a lot of those kinds of experiences, from all over the world, you know, Celinda.
Hey, Michael, would you give your website for the numerology? Because a lot of people have been asking me for that.
Well, we've got, let me go through the website thing with you because I have my main site, which is taroscopes.com. The Atlantis book is available there. If people want the e-book, they can go on to atlantisbook.com. So atlantisbook.com, all one word. They can buy the Atlantis book there and also the e-book version. If you're interested in becoming a member of our numerology website or just at least going and checking that out and seeing your own chart, it's called Personal Time Scopes, all one word, personaltimescopes.com. It's a wonderful piece of work we're offering. All my websites are services to people. They can go there and check this out, put in your date of birth, print out your chart, and then I've already been inundated with emails from people who've tried it, and they just can't believe how empowering it is because everything every day, you know, the synchronicity of numerology and astrology is incredible. And my DVDs, which are coming out in a couple of weeks, and there's six in the set, they have their own website. So, again, people have been emailing me and they're a bit confused. They have their own website, and the website is called Origins and Oracles. That's the name of the series. That's the name of the website. So if you want to browse the website for the DVDs, and we'll have previews there on that website, you can click on it and you'll see some streaming examples of the DVDs that are forthcoming. Go to originsandoracles.com. So it's Taroscopes, AtlantisBook.com, PersonalTimescopes.com, and OriginsandOracles.com. I've got a lot of websites out there because it's the age, the digital age, and this is the best and easiest and most efficient way to bring empowerment into people's lives. But right now we're really thrilled with the Personal Timescopes, the way that's come out and the responses that we're getting from people. You know, bring numerology into your lives because this is one of the most ancient of all sciences that was used by the ancients. I mean, J.P. Morgan, he's on record of saying the millionaires do not use astrology, but the billionaires do. I understand now what the man was talking about, why the famous are famous, why the rich are rich. They're using ancient subjects, but we can bring those up into a modern context right now by way of the Internet, and it's thrilling. It's remarkable.
Okay, let's go to our next callers. Let's go to our wild card line. Steve, punch that up for me. You're on Coast to Coast. Hi there. Hello?
Hello?
Yeah, hi. Welcome to the show. Where are you calling from?
This is Jose Barber from Arlington, Texas.
Hi, Jose. Go ahead, please.
I was wondering a question for Michael.
Yep, go ahead.
Is there any connection between, like, the 3 days of darkness in 2012 and...
Yes. Yes, there is.
All this that he's talking about?
Like, yeah, you hit it right on the head. I have a DVD coming out, because I know time is short on the radio. Jose, I have a DVD called 2012, Where History Ends. And on that DVD, we go into this very briefly. It has to do with a thing called the photon belt. Remember I was talking all through this program about that there's going to be divine intervention and help coming our way to eradicate this pathogenic virus from our planet? That has to do with physical, spiritual factor, which is called the photon belt. It's our universe, that means not our universe, but our solar system, that means our planet, the sun, and all the planets. Every 10,000 years or so, they pass through a band of very high radiation, okay, which is known as the photon band. Now, what you're talking about is to come, meaning that if the sun passes into that band before the Earth, it appears that the sunlight has gone out. And that will happen for 3 days. So the ancient mythologies talk about this. It's almost like a car wash for the whole of the solar system. Because Mother Nature, believe me, Mother Nature knows how to clean herself when she needs to, all right? So the roach cleaner is on his way. The car wash is on its way. If the sun passes into the radiation belt before the Earth, then the people on the Earth, that's us, will think, what the hell is happening? darkness, 3 days of darkness fall. If the earth goes in first, it will appear that the sky is on fire. So you have this kind of weird aurora borealis type of thing that's indescribable. The apocryphal works of the Bible talk about it, the ancient legends talk about it, and you're right, the Maya countdown to 2012 say that somewhere between the years 2008 and 2012, this kind of phenomena is meant to happen. I talk about it on the DVD called 2012, Where History Ends. I talk about several other types of phenomena, like constellational alignments. I'll be talking about this tomorrow at Conspiracy Con, the countdown to 2012. So, yeah, good question. Absolutely. Very much part of what we're talking about.
Let's go to our first-time caller line. Welcome to the program. Hi there.
Hi, George.
Yeah, hi. Where are you calling from?
I'm from Henderson, Nevada. My name is Michelle. It's an honor to speak to you.
Sure.
Hello.
Thing.
And Michael, I'm a huge fan of yours. I'm really happy to be able to talk to you.
Thank you, Michelle. I appreciate your call.
I have a question for you. I was always interested in how when Cortez went to the Mayans, he had found this library that the Mayans had, and he burned like the entire library.
Oh, sure.
Had 30,000 books. Do you have any idea what they contained or what they were about?
I have tremendous knowledge about what that is. I mean, you have in the Mayan concept there. Let me give you, to answer your question, let me read you, right?
Okay.
One little tiny paragraph from that codices right here. I have to explain this before I read it. This is a short paragraph from one of the only books to survive this unbelievable devastation that was unleashed on the Mexican people and on the South America. A great deal of their books, their ancient books that talk about the visitation and talk about the phenomenon we have been talking about, George. This is one of the sources that Michelle is talking about. Well, one of the surviving books was called the Popol Vuh, and I'm just going to read you a few lines from that book. And from these few lines, we should all be able to understand, for one, why those books were destroyed. Because if this is any example of what was in them, you know, if I was the Nephilim and their henchmen, I would want it destroyed. And this is the chapter. It says, and this is the gods speaking. It says, "Let us make him who shall nourish and sustain us. What shall we do to be invoked, to be remembered in earth? We have tried with our first creatures, but we could not make them venerate us. So then let us try to make obedient, respectful beings who shall nourish and sustain us." I mean, there's the gods talking about how they made a first creature, just like I explained, the Homo Atlantis, but that being was too intelligent and wouldn't serve them, right? Mm. And wanting servants, they went right ahead and made another group. If this is an example of what was in those books, and I believe that it was, because I've read other books like this. No wonder that, you know, Cardinal Deanda and these individuals went there on a wholesale purging of those books. And it's not the only place. They did it in Alexandria. They've done it in other places of the world. You know, there's 25 miles of bookshelves under the Vatican, 25 miles of caverns underneath there with sacred books on there. You know, what we have in the public domain is so few. You know, my book deals, we've been talking on this program about, you know, that my book goes into a few things that maybe no other book that is people have ever read goes into. There's two or three things that I cover that, to my knowledge, have never been covered before. You know, so little do we really have, and so much has been hidden from us.
West of the Rockies, you're on the air. Go ahead. Hi.
Hello?
Yeah, go ahead.
Oh, hi. George, this is Tara, and I was calling to ask Michael about, he was saying that Nephilims, that they were going to come out and openly rule at some point in time if some of these other things don't work out
right.
that they're planning.
Right.
But then at the same time that, is it because they're going to get stuck here?
Yeah.
That they would come out and openly rule?
Many of the people that work for them have already wanted to do this anyway. These guys are itching to do it. These people have a bit of a difficulty with their own dynasty. They have infighting in their own dynasties. And some of the groups that work in the inner cabal are already happy enough to do that anyway and kind of have been doing it. It's just that another group is saying, not yet. Let's not put that into policy yet. We still need the slave. And remember I said that sacrifices are very important. They've been feeding the undead. If you just kill off everybody, then you have no sacrifices. You have nobody to work. you see? And you have nobody to be in fear, because now it's all in, out in the open. It's not quite the same thing as this. There's many there's many kinds of fear, you see, Tara, and there's the open fear, but they prefer the fear that's also mixed up with confusion, the fear that's also mixed up with ignorance, the dumb human animal, you know, groveling in poverty, groveling in ignorance, crawling around like a crushed maggot, not knowing what's going on in the world around him, looking at the horrors being perpetrated, looking at the news and human beings. You know, it's like we sitting on a DV camera or, you know, watching a movie. That's why they watch the human race. They love it. They love us to be at each other's throats, murdering and killing each other, the human race. You know,
Michael,
I came from the streets of Belfast and watched this mayhem taking place. These people love it. So they want to eradicate us, and they kind of want us to be subjugated, but you know something? They're enjoying the show too much. So, you know, as long as we keep entertaining them, they keep tolerating us. But you're absolutely right.
Thank you for your call. We're out of time for any more calls. Michael, your toll-free number again for the book Atlantis.
Yeah, that's 206-527-2968. The instructions will be given about, you know, mailing, getting that book. It is only available for me right now. Atlantis Alien Visitation Genetic Manipulation. You can go onto the Taroscopes website and get it. There's an Atlantis page there for the shopping cart. There's also AtlantisBook.com. in which you can get the ebook version. But the number, again, is 206-527-2968. Certainly welcome your call, and we'll, you know, get your copy off to you as soon as possible. The DVDs are on originsandoracles.com, and we have this fascinating numerology website, which is one of many that we're producing, but this is an astounding invention. It's taken years of work to bring this most powerful module, this modality, into people's lives, and that's personaltimescopes.com.
Of all my guests and people who are writing in, Richard C. Hoagland and Robin say hello to you.
Oh, great. My other question to you is, are you going to be at ConspiracyCon? And I hope Richard is, because Richard is a fascinating person to talk to, and I come away enlightened every time I talk to him. And, of course, Robin, extend their warmest greetings. I hope we can see them at ConspiracyCon in the Bay Area.
All right, Michael. You take care of yourself.
That's a great pleasure, George. You take care of yourself. Thank you so much.
No problem. For Dan Galante, Steve Carr, Tom Danheiser, Lisa Lyon, Lex Lonehood, Sean Laudasaur, and Art Bell, I'm George Norrie. Somewhere out there on Coast to Coast AM, I'll see you on our next edition, Open Lines. See you then.